Good morning, everyone, and hope we've all been enjoying a wonderful conference, a lovely Shabbos. And now, in the words of Chazal, Koshel Lai Pridaschem. It's almost like, you know, you're at a chasen and you plan for months and months, and suddenly you realize that the end of the evening is coming approach, and you wonder, how did time fly so well? It's really been a wonderful weekend, and I'm sure everybody feels this sense of, a wonderful accomplishment that they've got a chance to meet and interact with lots of different people. So, Mirz Hashem will continue. But for this morning, we still have another program to complete. Now, I know how much time and schedules, you know, how it means, so this is very difficult for me to say, but we're going to start at 9:30, and it's all part of the master plan. So we will stick to a schedule. We'll be behind by 30 minutes. So just end of story. We're not trying to catch up. That's the end. Checkout is at 1 o'clock, with 1 o'clock, so we're not bound by any sort of, like, you know, hotel, you know, type of pressure. We'll just move the entire schedule by 30 minutes. All the speakers will be continuing their program. No catch-up intended. 30 minutes will be done by 12:30, Mr. Shem. The speakers will be speaking for 25 minutes each, and there will be 5 minutes of allotted time for questions. So we'll start with 9:30. The evaluations, please, were sort of... So the ones that are not related to the speakers, by now already, I hope you have enough of an impression that you can fill those out. And you can provide them. We'll send a little box around and we'll start collecting those. The last ones are for all the speakers. And needless to say, we need the feedback. It's an important component to it. We will be handing out the certificates this morning for those of you that require CME credit. So this morning's symposium, the focus is essentially the areas of elective medicine. And we've chosen five areas to discuss. The first one that we will be discussing is the issue of elective inductions of labor. And as you know, or you may know, that this becomes somewhat of an issue. And there's not only are there ethical questions with that, there certainly are, but there may be some halakhic questions as well. So without further ado, I will invite Rabbi Steinberg to begin our morning session. Slides up. Here we go.
Good morning. Since we're approaching Neila, I think that it's an opportunity to again thank the organizing committee, the hard workers of this successful and inspiring weekend that I'm sure everyone gained a lot and enjoyed, both from the spiritual point of view and from the Gashmi point of view. And again, I would like to thank Rabbi Kelman and Dr. Friedman and their Rebbetzins for the hard work they did to prepare it and during this time. And hopefully it will go on and continue. We have already a plan for next year. So the issue of elective of induced labor is a halachic question, and it's based primarily on the issue of the danger involved in the mere process of delivering and enhancing the danger or creating a new danger by changing the course, the natural course. So to begin with, according to the Gemara, halachically, a woman that gives birth is defined as dangerously ill to the degree that even if she feels fine and even if the physicians say that everything is okay, Shabbat can be desecrated, she's not allowed to fast on Yom Kippur, she is considered a chole sheyesh po sakana. The Gemara in Eruvin says that there are three types of people who die suddenly and unexpectedly, one of which is a woman in childbirth. And we know even to this day, although thank God it's very rare, but occasionally women have some complications and they unfortunately may even die during childbirth, so it certainly is even today a form of danger, but certainly in the old days, according to Chazal, it was considered to be a dangerous situation. The Medrash explains the biblical verse, a time to be born and a time to die, et lichyot ve'et lamut, to imply that when a woman is giving birth to a child, there are 99 chances that she may die and only one that she may live. That certainly seems to be a little bit exaggerated statistically. It's certainly not true today, but it gives you an understanding and a feeling that giving birth is a dangerous process. And although we observe that most women in childbirth do not die, contrary to the Medrash, which is more of a agadic approach, but still the body is disturbed at that time, and there is danger, according to the Orzarua, so that even though we understand, or we have already understood in the days of the Rishonim, that the danger is not very frequent, yet it is a danger. Now the question is, what type of childbirth is dangerous, and is there a difference between the danger, the skone, of a delivering mother and another illness that is considered to be dangerous? And indeed the poskim distinguish between what they call natural danger, sakana tivit, and unnatural danger. So that giving birth, which is the way of the world, and that is how the world runs, that is a natural danger, and since HaKadosh Baruch Hu made a woman to be pregnant and deliver, certainly he didn't intend that it should be a very frequent danger, like an illness, which is an occasional situation, unwanted situation, where the danger is greater. So there is a difference between natural and normal childbirth and another disease. That has been developed by Moshe Feinstein to a degree that became a machloikes amongst the poskim of our generation. Moshe Feinstein states that natural and normal birth in and of itself is not dangerous. Other than the three types of women who die during childbirth, which we say every Friday night, the women who don't keep nida, who don't light the candle of Shabbos, there are three types of women that their punishment, according to the Mishnah in Shabbos, is that they will die during childbirth. But other than this unusual type of women, according to Rav Moshe, there is no danger in the natural process of giving birth. His idea is based on the concept that since HaKadosh Baruch Hu instituted that death should be the way, it doesn't make sense that he made it to have a danger in it. So therefore, there is no danger. However, this is very hard to understand from the sources that I just mentioned, and indeed both Shevet HaLevi and the Mishneh Aloches oppose of Moshe Feinstein, reject his position, and they feel that there is a danger. However, it is a different form of danger compared to a regular sickness. That is, by the way, based on the Magid Mishneh in Hilchos Shabbos that says that you treat a delivering mother by shinui on Shabbos, whereas someone who has a real skone disease, you can treat him even without a shinui, because there is a difference between the types of the danger, whether it's natural and unnatural. But to go all the way, as Rav Moshe suggests, that there is really no danger in and of itself, that is a big chiddush, and most of the poskim did not accept it. So in order to induce earlier labor, which is not during the regular process of delivering, there are some medical procedures to do it, which by themselves may include some dangerous aspects to it, and therefore even the treatment itself, not only the induction of the labor and the early delivery, but the treatment itself has some form of danger. And there are at least three groups of reasons why a woman would go into earlier labor than the time that she would do it in a natural way. One is when there is a danger to the mother and the medical assessment is that she has to be induced earlier, because if you'll wait until natural labor will come, the mother will be endangered because of a sickness or a situation that she is in. The second condition is fetal distress. If the fetus is endangered and you must quickly take it out, otherwise he will be damaged or even die. And there is the more problematic aspect when it is done out of convenience. The mother says, I have a wedding at the time of the real time of delivery. I want to be okay then. I want already to have the child. So she wants it 2 weeks earlier and she goes and induces her labor. Or the physician says, I'm going on vacation. If you want me, do it a little earlier and we'll induce labor and I'll be your physician because otherwise I can't be, because I'm going to a conference that is here in Connecticut and I can't take care of you. So these are the main reasons why labor can be induced. So the halacha very clearly and without any dissenting opinion is that it is prohibited to induce labor unless there is a medical indication. So if it is a maternal or fetal indication to induce labor, by all means, that is part of the pikuach nefesh situation, both of the mother and of the fetus, and there is such a concept of pikuach nefesh of the fetus in and of itself, to the degree that the mother is allowed to eat on Yom Kippur, even if she is not in danger, in order to save the fetus, because his danger is considered already at least partial nefesh, and there is a pikuach nefesh in this situation. But unless there is a medical indication, either on the mother's side or the fetus' side, it is prohibited to induce this labor. And obviously one has to wait for the regular time. Now, another halachic aspect could have been that the time, the natural time for child delivery could be on Shabbat. And here we have a pious woman who says, I don't want to be mechalel Shabbos, so therefore I want to induce labor during the week and I'll gain chilul Shabbos. That is forbidden. That is not a reason to do it earlier, even for that reason. And even if it happens to be on Shabbat, you shouldn't avoid the Chilul Shabbos at the time when it comes and induce labor earlier. Moreover, if it is done on Shabbat, if the physician says, only on Shabbat I can do it, but otherwise Sunday I'm going already away and Shabbos is the last day, I am free, come in and I'll induce your labor, there is a Chilul Shabbos. Because it wasn't the right time, there was no indication to do it, and therefore it is not only prohibited per se, but you add to it an issue of desecrating the Shabbat. Now, why is it so? What are the reasons or the reason for not allowing earlier induction of labor? Who cares? If the woman wants it earlier, the physician wants it earlier, why shouldn't we do it? So the poskim, who all, as I said, agreed that it is not permissible, give different reasonings. One that almost everyone quotes is a Kabbalistic reason. In Kohelet it says that Akol Asa Yafe Beito, Kodesh Baruch Hu did everything nice or right when it is on time. So if you do it not on time, you do it in a time that you chose and not a Kodesh Baruch Hu chose, that will create a problem and therefore you shouldn't do it. The another reason is that we are born al-kor-chacha atachai, the fetus probably would love to stay in the womb forever, learn Torah, and not be bothered with all kinds of daily problems that someone who is born is encountered with. So don't push the time, don't take him out too early, because it's good for him to be there as long as HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants him to be there. The major halachic aspect, not so much ashkafic aspect, is that since the liver, the state of childbirth is a sakone, you're not allowed to put yourself in a sakone that you chose it. You do it out of your will to enter this type of sakone, which you are not allowed to do. Reb Moshe, based on his concept that timely child delivery is not a danger, says that if you go against the Kodesh Baruch Hu, who didn't want it to be happen now, then you enter into the danger of becoming a woman that gives birth, that is the danger. So he interprets all the sources of being in danger, even a natural childbirth, as a situation where it happens not according to the plan that HaKadosh Baruch Hu planned. And obviously from a medical point of view, as we said, the induction by itself is an added risk to the delivery, and therefore one is not allowed to do it unless there is a halachic reason to do so. Now, on the other hand, as we said, if there is a maternal or fetal danger, then obviously induction of labor is not only permissible, but actually mandatory, because you have to save the life or the well-being of the mother and the fetus. Another circumstance which has been discussed was that if the woman is post-term, and there's a feeling that the time comes that the baby has to come out, but the natural process is delayed for some reason, then induction of labor is permissible, and according to the Shmirat Shabbat, even if it has to be done on Shabbos. We said earlier that if you do it on Shabbos not timely, just because of convenience, it's a Chilul Shabbos. But if it's a post-term situation, and for some reason you missed a few days that you could do it during the weekday, and now comes the time that according to the physician it may cause problems to the post-term baby, then you can induce it even on Shabbat. Now, there are some who say that if the obstetrician is indeed leaving town and the woman has an affinity to him and she trusts him and she wants Dafka that he should be the one to do it, and he says, if I won't induce it, I won't wait for the time that you have, some say that then it would be permissible. And other such similar situations that might be permissible. So these are actually the hallmarks of induction of labor, both prohibited and permissible, depending on the circumstances. Now, I would like to add a few other issues related to obstetrical questions, which I think come up quite frequently, and since I have a few more minutes, I'll try to go through the other issues as well. One issue is, can we halachically enforce a C-section for fetal indication? There are situations where the fetus is in distress, and the physicians feel that C-section must be done as early as possible in order to reduce the harm to the fetus, and the mother refuses. She says, I don't want to go a C-section, I'll wait, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will help, everything will be fine, and I'll wait for the time to come. So there is a machloikes between Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and Rav Eliashiv. According to Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, she should be persuaded from medical point of view to accept and to consent to do the C-section for the fetal well-being, but she cannot be coerced. The reason is that there is no obligation to put oneself into added danger, certainly for an unborn fetus. In other words, the halacha is that a person has to save someone else, lo tamad al dam re'echa, but not on the cost of his endangerment. He shouldn't endanger himself to a certain degree in order to save someone else. Now, if this is true for an adult to an adult, says of Shlomo Zalman, it is certainly true from an adult to a fetus, because the mother always takes precedence over the fetus, and therefore, since C-section is an added risk to the natural delivery, this added risk she is not mechuyav, she's not obligated to take, and therefore you can't force her. So that was the position of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Aval Yashiv, I discussed it with them personally. I don't know if it was published elsewhere. Perhaps in the meantime it was published. But he felt that a woman should be obligated, is obligated, and should be enforced to have a C-section for the fetal sake, because he felt that the added risk of a C-section in modern days to a natural childbirth is a very small added risk, and such a small risk one is obligated to take in order to save someone else, certainly an adult, but in his opinion even for a baby. And the source for it is the examples that the Gemara gives on Lo Tamad Al Dam Re'echo. What are the situations where one cannot stand idle by someone else's danger? So the Gemara gives three examples. One is that you see someone drowning, so you have to go in and save his life. The second is, if you see a beast running after someone, you have to save his life by killing the beast. And thirdly, if robbers or murderers are running after someone, you have to save his life. Says Rav Eliashiv, all these examples are not zero risk for the rescuer. Obviously, even if he knows how to swim, and even if the waters are shallow, if someone is drowning, he may also drown. So there is some risk involved. Certainly if he has to fight a beast or a murderer, it is not a zero risk. And yet the Gemara says that this is the obligation of Lo Tamad Al Dam Re'echo. There's a famous Radbaz that tries to make some sense when is a danger such that you are not mechuyav on Lo Tamad or even prohibited, and when not. It's a complicated Radbaz. There are some contradictory tshuvas in the Radbaz himself. I won't go into it, but if there is a small risk involved and there is 100% risk to the person that you need to save, then you are mechuyav to do it. And since the estimation is that the fetus will suffer unless C-section will be done, or perhaps even die, you should enforce it. Now, everyone agrees that in the following situations, C-section should not be done, even though it can help in some way. Firstly, obviously, if the C-section on a particular woman has a greater risk than the regular, let's say that she has a cardiac disease, and for her to undergo anesthesia and have all the procedure of the C-section may add a significant risk, then even according to Aval Yashiv, you are not mechuyav. The second is, if the fetus has a severe malformation or disability, and in order to save him, to force the mother to do a C-section and then have a fetus that is severely disabled, that Aval Yashiv said is no obligation. And I must admit that I couldn't discuss it with him too much, but I didn't understand his position on that. Because according to him, you're not allowed to abort such a fetus. So this fetus is to be alive. Now, it's clear that if he is suffering and you add to his suffering the delay and not doing a C-section, you're worsening his condition. So why not have the same concept of saving whatever is there to save, even if the mother disagrees, but that was his psak. Now, obviously, if there is a dispute amongst the physicians whether C-section is indicated in this situation, or whether the fetus indeed needs the C-section right away or can wait, then the mother can say, I am going according to those physicians who say that the C-section is not indicated at the moment. It's sort of a kimli. She can say, I accept this position and not the other. So only if it is clear that unless C-section will be done, the fetus will either die or suffer damage, only then, says the Rav Eliashiv, you can even enforce, and Rav Shlomo Zalman says, you can't. This is one added issue. The second added issue that I want briefly to bring to your attention is a long-standing issue of the presence of the husband during child delivery of his wife. There are a lot of methods today of teaching the woman all kinds of behaviors of breathing and so on that her delivery will be easier and less painful. And part of several of these methods is that the husband is part of the delivery system. And he is in the delivery room and encourages his wife and tells her, now breathe, now don't breathe, whatever the method is saying. And that is supposed to be very helpful to women who deliver. Problem is that the husband's presence in the delivery room may cause halachic problems. One is that he is not allowed to look at private parts of his wife. And secondly, he is not allowed to touch her because she becomes a nida once delivery starts. And some of these methods are that he taps her or holds her hand or does something which is physical contact, which certainly halachically would create a shy. So therefore, because of these two issues, the nida situation where you can't touch her and the gazing at her private parts, there are some poskim who decided that the whole method is prohibited and the husband should never enter the delivery room, even if the system calls for it or the method that they did calls for it, because the fear is that once he will be there, he may transgress these two prohibitions. And there's a whole host of poskim like the Minchas Yitzchak and the Debreziner and the Rabbi Halberstam, a lot of poskim who forbid this situation. And they give a whole host of reasons why that shouldn't be done. Some of them are historic. They said, our mothers delivered without their husbands there, and we came out fine, and our mothers were fine. So who says that the modern world has to do something different? It's fine to have the same way we had it. And if we tell the woman that it is prohibited, she'll manage without it. If she thinks that it's okay and she wants it, perhaps really it helps her. But if you tell her it's not okay, so she'll do without it. But there are others who do not prohibit it and actually even allow it. And the reasoning against it seem to be, let's say, weak reasonings. A, it's a gzeira. If you tell the husband you're allowed to be with your wife in order to help her, but you're not allowed to gaze at her private parts and to touch her, so we can assume that if he wants to do the right way, he won't do it. You are afraid that he'll do it. So that is a gzeira. And we have no power nowadays to add new gzeiras. If there wasn't a gzeira that Chazal made, who are we to make new gzeiras? So that is on a principle way. The fact that in previous generations the husbands didn't go in is not entirely correct, because in previous generations women, A, delivered at home, not in hospitals, and B, they had a lot of friends around them. The Gemara tells about many stories of friends who support the woman, and the whole system was different. Now, she is delivering in a hospital, in a setup which is totally strange to her and foreign to her, and perhaps really this causes a lot of anxiety. And why not help her the way that it used to be, although it wasn't the husband necessarily, but someone close to her was there. And most importantly, Chazal viewed the delivering situation as a dangerous situation, as we said earlier. And because of fear of tiruf hadas, confusion of the delivering mother, Chazal allowed isura deoraita, not as a chashash of an isura deoraita, but actually to do it, in order to set her mind quietly. And the famous example is that if a blind woman is delivering on Shabbos, and she requests that there be a light there because she wants to be sure that people see what they are doing there, although she doesn't see. The halacha is that you're allowed to put a light on Shabbos to put her at ease, and not even do what people call a slow code. Tell her we did it. She wouldn't know anyway the difference if they put the light or not. She's blind. Yet you're not allowed to deceive her. You're allowed to do something which is an issur d'oraita in order to appease her mind. So certainly, if today the assumption is that women will feel better when the husband is there and there's no issur involved, it's only a chashash of an issur, an exera, and there's no circumstances that used to be in the old days, and it's a new situation, it's hard to understand where the issur comes from and why it should be forbidden. And indeed, Rav Moshe Feinstein gave a heter to it, and he accepted this, and there are many other poskim. Shlomo Zalman had an in-between position. He said that really it's not the way to be done, but if individually a woman says this is important for her and the husband really is part of her well-being, then it can be allowed and there should be no question about it. Thank you. According to those who do not allow for mere convenience, it will be the same thing. I mean, you'll do it only at the time that medically it's indicated. As I said, even if it turns out to be on Shabbos, you're allowed to induce it on Shabbos, provided medically this is the right timing. But if the right timing is Monday, and you say, let's do it on Sunday because it's a nicer time to make the bris, that even if it's a post-term, doesn't make any sense. Why should you do it? You shouldn't interfere for convenience in the process that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is doing. You should use medical indications only.
You don't mind, just ask a question. There's a growing trend in our hospital that I've called to deliveries, which are called too posh to push. So these are women that are too sophisticated and do not want to deliver naturally. So they electively choose to deliver by cesarean section, planned, booked, I'll book it on such and such a date. Two questions. One, can she do it? And two, can the obstetrician perform that cesarean section? No medical indication other than the fact that she has chosen the date.
No, so as I said, according to all poskim that I know, that would be wrong. Wrong on her side to enter such a situation, and wrong on the physician's side to endanger her by doing something which is no need to do. If medically, the idea is it has to be medically indicated. It can't be a convenience reason. And that is obviously some type of a convenience measure, and therefore I don't see any hazard to it.
Mark?
So, first thing is that recommendations now by the American College of the UN is not that you never do someone earlier than 39 weeks unless there's a severe medical reason for it. So, a lot of the special people were being used 37 or 38 weeks. No hospital in the United States is going to really tolerate that anymore. And from having a Sunday risk, most of the hospitals don't have the staffing and will not allow the elective C section to possibly push or the induction to happen on Friday night, Shabbos, or Sunday, because of staffing and other reasons. So people don't really reflect that they want to have Tuesday risk instead of Wednesday risk. You do get patients who want to have Pisces and they don't want the birth time or something like that. The bigger problem that we face in our practice is where the patient, when we tell the patient there is a medical reason for it, they go to their Rebbe, and the Rebbe says to them, no, you can't, even the doctor is saying. So there's kind of a bigger issue when you have to discuss like this is, is a medical reason that the Rabban should be saying, the doctor says it's necessary, and not like, oh, you're not in a blanket, you can't do this. And that's where I think part of the education for them is.
Yeah, I mean, the Rabbanim physician encounter is not always a simple one. I'll give you even a further, a more complicated example. In our hospital, in Shara Tzedek, a Hasidic woman who comes to the liver and there are complications and she needs a C-section, she wouldn't allow it until she consults with her Rebbe. But her Rebbe is now in the mikveh and he is davening and he can't answer. And in the meantime, the baby is dying, the fetus is dying. What do you do in this situation?
Patient with a previous cesarean section. Patient has two options for delivery, either elective repeat cesarean section, in which case one would elect to deliver at a time chosen that's convenient for the doctor and the patient, although there is an indication for delivery. Second option is attempting vaginal birth after cesarean section. Both of these options carry with them increased risks depending on depending on your calculation of risk, maybe one, maybe more, maybe less, but they both carry with them increased risk. So halakhically, what is the way we approach determining how to deliver the patient with previous cesarean?
So halakhically, I think, would depend who asks the shayla. Is it the patient or the physician? If it's the physician, he has to be convinced that one of the two options is a better option. I mean, you can disagree with another physician, but you have to have a position. So if your position is that once a C-section, always a C-section, if it's still true, then you recommend to do a C-section and it's an elective C-section. If you think that today there is no reason to do once C-section, always C-section, so let her deliver regularly from your point of view as a physician. But since it is a disputable matter, then the patient has the right to choose one way or the other. That's what the poskim have said.
Okay, thank you very much. I think I'm going to introduce this part as being part two of the Friday night Oneg. There are actually a husband and wife team that are going national now on the circuit. So, Rabbi Glad, tell us what we could do.
Okay. So again, my also Hakaras Hatov for the wonderful, wonderful conference. We Baruch Hashem been here every single year since the start. We're thrilled to be a small part of it. You really deserve a tremendous amount of Habatz's Torah credit, and Mitzvah Hashem should be zochet to continue many, many, many years. So everybody's probably familiar with the famous article that was written earlier this year. It was published in one of the major lay papers that talked about the potential need for a woman to undergo plastic surgery to increase her risks of a shidduch. So I'd like to address that in two parts. A haskafic part, which everybody doesn't want to hear, and everybody says, I know that, which is probably much more important. And then the part that everybody wants to hear about is the halachic part. Can I or can I not do it? Okay. So let's look at what the Gemara has to say about plastic surgery. I found a case of liposuction in the Gemara, which is probably one of the classical cosmetic procedures. In the Gemara in Bava Metzia, Rav Elazar Rav Shimon was, I don't want to use the word accused, but he was being very strongly argued with by the Rabbanim about a practice that he did, which was being moser bad Jewish people to the local authorities. And it's a famous Gemara, and everybody says, well, you know, what does this have to do with life? And the answer is, it has a lot to do with life. We can learn a lot of principles from these Gemaras. And Rabbi Elazar Rav Shimon, Gemara says, drank an anesthetic, and he underwent self-liposuction to determine if his fat would in fact become wormy, because a person who sins, so his body decays, but it's tzaddik. Right, a person who's a great person. There are many stories of people that have uncovered the kvarim from great Yidolim. You know, the Gemara tells us about Abram and Yitzchak and Yaakov, that they're sitting in the Moras HaMachpelah, they're talking to each other. It's very strange. Gemara is difficult to understand, but the concept is that if you're tzaddik, your bones, your body will not necessarily decay, as will a normal person's bones and body decay. So he was checking while he was alive, so he did liposuction. So none of the Mefarshim, none of the posts can talk about, it's also to do liposuction. The only question is, you know, should a person undergo such a type of a self-introspection or a physical check? But the Gemara clearly describes that he did liposuction on himself. The Gemara Nadari. So random Gemaras that I picked out that give us, I think, some concept of this idea of plastic surgery. So Rabbi Shmuel says, and this is really the hashkafic part of the talk that I wanted to allude to, that is more important than anything else I'm going to say. Rabbi Shmuel says that all women are created beautiful. Unfortunately, poverty can mask, can unfortunately not make it so recognizable, the godliness of the Jewish woman, the godliness of Bas Yisrael, how beautiful she is, and unfortunately can make them appear unattractive. So the idea on the highest level is that nobody would ever care about somebody's physical appearance because it's their inner beauty that really is important. And that is something that needs to be stressed to both boys and girls when they're going on a shidduch, that there's a certain concept out there that I have to have a certain look or a certain appearance. And that's more important than what's inside, the nidos and all of the beautiful things that we associate with truly being a Ben Yisrael or a Bas Yisrael. And that's something that we need to do all a much better job in teaching to know what's the ikur and what's the tofel. Another Gemara, Mabava Metzia, Rav Yochanan. Rav Yochanan is described as one of the last shipurei, the beautiful people. But he didn't make fully the cut. And the Gemara tells us in a number of places Rav Yochanan was morbidly obese. He would be a prime candidate for bariatric surgery today. He was literally unable to move. The Gemara says, just had this in the Daf Yomi, he couldn't even tilt fully to his side to say Kriya Shema. He was so obese, he could only tilt a little bit. If you're as obese as Rav Yochanan, it's acceptable. For a regular person, you have to turn fully to your side if you have to say Kriya Shema lying down. So we see an important idea over here. Rav Yochanan is described as being absolutely beautiful. Except he didn't have a beard. And that's why he wasn't beautiful. He was morbidly obese, what we would describe as morbidly obese. So therefore, another concept we see from Chazal, from the Gemara, is that there is no objective standard of beauty. And maybe that goes back to point number two. We need to teach people that looking like the latest fashion model on some secular preacher sticker type of magazine is certainly not what we should be striving for. Both unhealthy, not getting into a discussion about anorexia, not getting into a discussion about bulimia, not getting into a discussion about major problems in the Jewish community, in the frum Jewish community, in terms of eating disorders, because people have this very unhealthy body image of what somebody should ideally look like if you want to be a kala. So again, another Gemara. Gemara in Ksubas. Ketzad Meraktus Me'akala. This Gemara is, of course, written down after the song of the same name. And we have the famous Machlokas, which reveals Beis Hillel Beis Shammai. And basically, the position of Beis Hillel is, I don't want to say this too harshly, but you can lie to her face and tell her that she looks beautiful. Beis Shammai says, no, you got to tell it like it is. But he still says, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. Why is it not called lying? Because Mistama HaChasim thinks she's beautiful. Right? Hopefully every single spouse thinks that their partner is beautiful. And that is a concept that we also have to ingrain and talk into the younger people when they're talking about Shidduchim. Finally, the Gemara tells us, the Medrash actually, Rabbi Akiva said, was asked the question by Tonus Rufus, if God created us perfect, why do we need to do Bris Milah? And Akiva gives him back a famous analogy. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted us to eat bread, yet bread doesn't grow in the fields, although originally in the time of Adam HaRishon, Yerushalmi says, Yitz Hashem, when the time of Mashiach comes, you will go to a tree and pick off a pumpernickel or a bagel or a rye bread. The bread used to grow on the trees, and in Yitz Hashem it will. So the Medrash tells us, the source is at the very bottom of the slide, HaKadosh Baruch Hu provides us with the raw materials, but we are allowed to go and try to improve upon them, i.e. Bris Milah and many other things. What about some Talmudic thoughts on beauty? halachically, it is improper, considered wrong, to go and marry a woman without having seen her first. What's the purpose for that? If the Rosh Yeshiva extols her virtues and says that, oh, this woman's a, you know, balas chesed, and she's such a great balas nidos, and she knows how to cook well, and she's a great mechanecha, your children will be gedolei hador. So what do you have to look at it for? Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu created us with the Yetzer Tov and the Yetzer Hara. And one of the explanations of Alevavecha, again, recently from the Daf Yomi, is to teach us you have to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yetzer Hara. Yetzer Hara is strongly trying to elicit you to do all sorts of aveiros, sexual improprieties and dvarim ha'asurim. So you have to harness that Yetzer Hara and use it l'tov. There's a mitzvah of onah. There's a mitzvah for the husband. It's so fakert from what the secular world says. The obligation is upon the husband to go and please his wife. As opposed to in the secular world or in other religions where the wife has to do her wifely duty. By us, there's an obligation of owner on the husband to please his wife. And the only way one can really do that is if one enjoys being with one's spouse. And therefore, the Gemara tells us that a husband has to go and see his wife first before he marries her. It's improper not to. Further support of this idea is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu anesthetized Adam HaRishon when he took out the tzela. Everybody translated it as a rib. None of the Mepharshim translated it really as a rib. Some translated it as other body parts, possibly a tail. Whatever it was, he anesthetized Adam HaRishon so he shouldn't be disgusted by his wife. If he says, that's where she came from, it could chas v'shalom lead to a meal sticker type of approach. I don't want to hold her hand. I don't want to be with her. Well, she used to be part of me. I used to be a rib. She used to be a piece of me. And now, so in order to protect the husband-wife relationship, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, b'chvod v'atzmo, did plastic surgery, so to say, did anesthesia. Min hadin, you're allowed to divorce a wife, rachmana litzlan, if she's physically displeasing to you. Now, hashkafically, not a great thing to suggest, and a rav would try to counsel. But so much so, we paskin like this opinion of Beis Hillel, that if a person finds his wife displeasing, he's allowed to divorce her. So we see that there is something that HaKadosh Baruch Hu put into the Bria, husband and wife should be pleasing to each other. And what further, if you want to look at it from a Hashkafa point of view, Kimat, all of the great women in Jewish history have all been described, Yefas Toar Ma'od, Yofahi Ma'od, they're all described as beautiful. Now, some of the commentators say this Torah Nafi Midos, but most take it literally and say that they had physical beauty, and it's described in a very positive way. So that's one aspect, and you have to contrast that with Sheker Achein VeHelel HaYofi. We don't consider beauty to be up there in the important things in life. That's the Ashkafic part. And we need to go and talk about this to our sons, to our daughters, and tell them that if it doesn't meet what your unfortunately warped sense is by the outside world of beauty, so then you're going to miss out on a lot of tremendously wonderful, positive shiduchim if you have this incorrect, inappropriate, halachically, hashkafically, improper sense of what your kala or your chosin should look like. And that's the first part of the talk. Everybody nods their head to that part of the talk and nobody ever listens to it. That's unfortunate, but that's a lack on the part of the Rabbanim, that's a lack on the part of the Rosh Yeshiva, that's a lack a part of all the people that can be involved in this, to tell people that not every single Kala is going to be able to win the Miss America Beauty Pageant. And Baruch Hashem that's the case. Because that's not what's really important. And 25 years later, hopefully the marriage will be stronger and better, but I guarantee you, with only, rare exceptions, that people don't age very, very well. Some age less poorly than others. But if you're going to have a marriage for 60, 70 years in Yitzhak Hashem, Kinai Nahara, so if you think your kala at the age of 20 is going to look the same at the age of 90, you're very mistaken. And if you think that the love that you have at the age of 20 is going to be the love that you have at the age of 90, I feel very bad for you. Because the love at the age of 90, hopefully, Nitzah Shem, I look forward to finding out, is much stronger love than at the age of 20, even though the physical appearances are possibly, at least in my case, not in my wife's case, would be somewhat different. So that's the hashkafic part of the talk. What about the halachic part of the talk? No! Okay, I heard that hashkafic part, but I still would like her to look beautiful. Or she says, nobody wants to go out with me. I hear the Hashkafic part of Torah, but my nose is, you know, Pinocchio would be happy to have plastic surgery to have my nose. So what's the deal? So you have to go again. As all things, you have to look at the source material. And the Gemara talks about it. And I know it didn't come out in the sheets, so I have a little trepidation as I turn to the next slide. And you're going to get the gibberish that came out into the sheets. At least the source material came out right. We'll see if it comes up here correctly. So you go look at the Gemara. It talks about the din of chavala. Most of the plastic surgery problems, you see from the tshuvas that we'll talk about, come into two categories. Either chavala, there's an issa to damage somebody, including yourself. And then there's an issa, as Steinberg Shlita just spoke about so eloquently, the issa of putting yourself into a matzav of sakana. You're not supposed to do anything that puts you into a matzav of sakana. So just like a pregnant woman shouldn't put herself earlier than necessary into the labor sakana situation, so too. So don't put yourself under the knife. Don't put yourself into a plastic surgery situation that potentially involves sakana. Those are the two major issues that deal with this subject. So, Baruch Hashem, it comes out here. So the Gemara in Bava Kama, and the Rambam essentially quotes this Gemara, also, Yodim Lachbol Ben Ba'atzbol Ben Bechavero. It is a forbidden action to go and damage. Whether you're doing it yourself, or you're doing it with your friend. Lachavu Bovad, not only the one who damages, Ever Kol Hamake Odom Koshim Yisroel Ben Kotb Ben Godl Ish Ben Isha, Derech Mitzoyin in a fight, Hareza over below Sasi, over a low Sasi. So there is a valid, bona fide, inarguable Kuliyama Lupligi Issa called Chavola. Okay? That's the basic etzim din. Okay? How do you deal with that from a practical point of view? So, if somebody comes up and he says, am I allowed to go punch him in the face because I don't like him? So, it's simple. You don't need the gun like dog. You don't have to ask a great post to say, no, you're not allowed to hit somebody. Rosh Olam HaSakes Riyach. Another Gemara in Sanhedrin. Afilu lahagdiya yodo al chaveiro osur. Even to lift your hand against a friend, not to necessarily do chavala to him. You're not such a great puncher. You're not going to do a physical act of muscular damage to the person. So you're not allowed to raise your hand to somebody. Even the threat, so to say, of hitting him, I raise a rasha. So again, building a case here for the strength and the severity of this issue called chavala. People don't take it seriously. Person has to be very careful not to damage somebody else. Again, the Rambam essentially passing the Gemara straight out. So, what's the issue with plastic surgery? So the Mishnah Bava Kama says, a person who wounds himself, he's doing it to himself, while it's prohibited, shouldn't do this, but he doesn't have to pay any monetary damages. But if somebody else does this to him, that's partial, who's he going to pay it to? But somebody else that does it has to pay monetary damages. The Gemara says, "Man tama dishamas le dama ino de mashal chabul biatzma." Who is the opinion that says you're not allowed to go damage yourself? It's Rav Elazar ben Akapor. Okay, and he says as follows. Read the Gemara a little bit further down. He says it's a kavul chomer. Umaze nikwa chote shalot tzir atzmo elamin hayayin. A person who's a nazir is not allowed to drink wine or wine products, grape products. And he's called a chote, according to this opinion. Because he's mitzai himself, he pains himself. So certainly, ha mitzar atzlam, we call dover, somebody does physical damage, alach has kama v'kama. So it's also to do it to yourself. I want it done. You're not allowed to do it to yourself. Another gemara in Bava Kama. The person, sine es enai, somebody says to somebody else, go blind me. Kateyas Yodi, go cut my arm off. Shaver Ragli, go cut my leg off, break my leg. Even if he says, over here, you're not allowed to do that. He says, Amanas Liftar, but I give you permission to do so and I won't charge you for it. You know, I'm letting you do it. It's chayv. You're not allowed to do that. The Rambam over here says, there's a difference between monetary damages and body damages. If somebody says to his friend, blind me, cut my hand off, or break my leg, he says if he does it, that he shouldn't be obligated from a monetary point of view, he's still chayav in all the five damages. Why? Nobody would want to be damaged. It's a very important implication in this Rambam. If you're in a case where the vast majority of people would want to be damaged, this opens a Pesach, this opens up a potential huge, huge kula over here. Until now I pointed out Osir, but based upon this Rambam, there now becomes an introduction over here to, is there some permissibility if people would want this done? So let's look in Shulchan Aruch. He can't pass it from a Gemara, he can't pass it from a Rambam, Shulchan Aruch, Choshen Mish, but it says, Mechaber writes, you're not allowed to damage yourself. Okay? So from a financial point of view, there's differences, but it's also to damage yourself. The Miras 9, the Sanmor says, even though the person says, I don't care, I'm letting you damage me, nobody else should do this. Because the one who damages himself transgresses the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want you to be damaged. That's what the Sanmor says. How do we translate that into practical modern day anesthesia, modern day technology, laser technology, which is bloodless to a certain extent, procedures that can be done with minimal blood loss, procedures that can be done with essentially the risk being 0.000 in terms of loss of life? How's that, the source material that they just provided you doesn't really address this? And as far as I could tell, I couldn't find the tshuva on this subject until 1961. First tshuva that I saw is by Rabbi Lord Emanuel Jacobowitz Zatzal, who is considered by many to be the father of Jewish medical halacha. So he wrote a paper in 1961 that was presented actually to, I think, the Royal College of Surgeons in England. It was published, I believe, in Asia. And subsequent to that, there are a number of tshuvas written by great gedolim that I'd like to go through. So I put Rabbi Emanuel Jacobowitz at the bottom, but he really should have been at the top, but I don't have his tshuva. Is more of a secular type of a publication where he outlines certain principles. So in your packet, behind the PowerPoint, you actually have some of these tshuvas over here that you can look at yourself. So I'm going to highlight only certain parts of it, because these are the practical tshuvas. Now, there was a rabbi in 1964, who, it's just interesting to see how life has changed. The rabbi writes the tshuva over here, the question rather. This rabbi is from the great Halberstam dynasty. He's the Admor from Chechenov. And in the tshuva, he asked this question to Mordechai Yaakov Breisch Zatzal, the great going from the past generation from Switzerland, Breisch, Chelkis Yaakov. And the questioner, he writes his name back to him and says, you, the questioner, Rav Shalom Yecheskel, Yechune Reuben. His name was Reuben. He was known as Reuben. Nobody would write that in the tshuva today. They would only write the very Jewish name. He was called Reuben. Reuben Halberstam. He was an Admor. He was known as Reuben. Yechune Reuben Halberstam. Anyway, he's in Brooklyn in 1964. Apparently this Rav Halberstam writes the same question to two great gedolim. He writes it to Rav Mordechai Yaakov Breisch, who published this in 1964. And he also wrote it to the Mishnah Halachos, the Umva Rebbe, Rav Menashe Kleiner. It's also unfortunate to announce that Zatzal, who was Nifter about 2 years ago. And he wrote a famous large compendium called the Mishnah Halachos. The same exact question was apparently separately sent to these two gedolim, and they both responded in 1964 with a tshuva. And essentially, we'll first go through the Chelkis Yaakov. The Chelkis Yaakov is, again, one of the first published tshuvas on this subject. It says there's two potential problems that I already addressed. Also, l'chavel atzmo, it's prohibited for a person to go and harm oneself. And if you're looking at the packets for this, this is found, I think, on page 137 in the packets. Underlined some key parts. I'm not going to read through the whole tshuva. But two questions, he says. Are you allowed to damage yourself, and you're allowed to put yourself into a matzav sakana? So it's always interesting when you're writing one of the first tshuvas on a subject, you got like an open page, and to see what types of raya's great individuals can think of, that you know the story, you know the exact situation that they're talking about, never would have occurred, at least to me, to even think that this could be used as a guideline over here. So he brings down that if a person brings down a Goren Shabbos, in Eilo Tsar Acher Elosh Mizbayish Lelech Bein Bnei Odom Shori, certain things you're allowed to do in Shabbos because it causes you pain. And he brings here an interesting raya. There's no greater pain to a person than psychological pain. And a person who is physically healthy, gets a clean bill of health from every single vital statistic, may be somebody who is a chola in certain regards because of psychological pain. A psychological pain in halacha should not be dismissed. It shouldn't be considered unimportant. It shouldn't be considered that. It's all in your head. That's a very wrong halachic attitude. And he basically brings down over here that therefore, mistama, if this young lady, bosha imchotma, if this young lady who had a big nose, and the question was asked, can she go for plastic surgery to have a nose job? If she's embarrassed, lelech ben chevrosel, b'nesha isha miskanas b'yerech averta. Women get more dressed up for other women than they do for men. That's a secret I've learned over the years as well. So she's embarrassed to go, even to the social women's engagement that she's in. Never mind for a shidduch. That's considered a busha. And he says that's considered tsar godo. Ein lecha tsar godo mizeh, he writes. And he says, Inkein harelon halacha psuka. B'pnei tsar mutu lach toch es ha'eber lahak yizdam. Ve'ein bezeh mishum osach habuvim. So the Chalkis Yaakov says it's perfectly permissible from the point of view of Chavala. This isn't called Chavala. If a person has appendicitis, we don't say, well, the surgeon's going to do Chavala, so it's awesome. The surgeon's saving your life. This is equivalent, I don't call it saving your life, but it's saving a person from pain. A person's allowed to undergo a procedure because they're having pain. So this is allowed, halachically allowed, because they're having pain. That's point number one. What about the question of you're bringing into a chash sakana? You're allowed to enter into sakana? He says, no. The doctors have the ability to do this today with almost minimal risk. He says, especially the frat bayoros hagdolos, the technique, hanituach lirapos, holeches, umasadedes, kadim, yom yom, vitzodim, hochi, gdolim. Each day the technology gets better, it advances, it improves to the point where, you know, when I went to medical school, we were told the risk of general anesthesia was somewhere in the area of 1 in 25,000. I think today, an anesthesiologist that had that risk of general anesthesia would probably be not considered the greatest anesthesiologist. Maybe the risk is now 1 in 50,000, 1 in 100,000, the person dying because of the anesthesia. I don't recall the last time I heard about a plastic surgery case ending in a death. I didn't read about it in a journal, didn't read about it in any newspaper. Somebody dying from a nose job today must be exceedingly rare. And he basically says it fits within the Dosh Be'rab and the concept that we spoke about in the Teats of the Path. It's an acceptable risk. People accept this. The technique has reached such a level of success that it's permissible. The Mishnah Halachos essentially says the same thing. He brings different rayas. He says that he brings down the Tosfos and a very interesting question, the Tosefta and then the Tosfos. She talks about if a woman makes a neder that if a man makes a neder that he was a Makadish woman, Amanas, that she doesn't have a mug. She doesn't have any blemishes. And then it turns out she has a blemish. So the Tosefta brings down, if she goes to a doctor and corrects it and doesn't have the blemish, versus if she goes to a Chacham who's matir the neder. Listen to this. So the Chacham who's matir the neder, he said, can uproot the neder. It didn't exist. So therefore, at the time that she was with Kadi, she didn't have a problem. But the doctor who does this only does it mikan lahaba. He says the kedushin is a toast. That's what the Tosefta says. Because at the time that she was married, she had the blemish. She doesn't have it now, but it was amanasa. She didn't have a blemish at the time that she got married. So he brings her there, arises. Nobody questions and says, hey, it's also to do plastic surgery to correct the mum. So from the fact that he says that nobody there discusses in that Tosefta, how could you do the plastic surgery to correct the mum? He says, obviously, if it's a mum, you'll have to correct it. And it's not a problem of chavala, you're doing it for the betterment of the person. I asked this, incidentally, to a person, Shechta Shlita, and that's his opinion as well. It's not published, but he's spoken about it on a number of occasions. I talked with him about this. So his opinion is, if it's something that the woman wants, it's not called chavala. He defines the Rambam when he talks about chavala. It has to be something that's unwanted. But if most people would want it in this situation, and this person is included in that group, doesn't consider that chavala, and therefore these poskim consider it perfectly acceptable. Is there anybody that disagrees? So I'm running out of time, ladies. What time do I have to? So let me quickly conclude then with the one opinion that's very strong, very stark, that's a Tzitz Eliezer against this. Tzitz Eliezer essentially says, how dare you go and try to correct what HaKadosh Baruch Hu did? And that this is something that is wrong and absolutely improper. And he says, I won't read the whole thing, I underline the parts that are important. He says that it's totally wrong to do this. He says, Eino kedai afilu lo hoshev al zeh. I can't believe I'm even asked this question, that I should be asked to comment on doing something like this. And he says, all the Midrashim to talk about the beauty of beauty, the bottom line is, shekachem ve'el v'la yofi. And he says, al kach niru la halacha da'osula liyodun lasos nituach plasti. But Tzitz Eliezer, the woman of Zatzal, says, absolutely forbidden to do plastic surgery. Chen l'rofe, the rofe is not allowed to do this if it's for the purposes of yofi. Ain't la'arif, nothing more to be said on the subject. Basically, the Mincha Shlomo says that there's permissibility, if there's Moshe says permissibility. Bottom line is, if you have vast majority of poskim that say it's permissible. And this list is basically what I could come up with, and I think Lekuliyam, I think even the Tzitz Eliezer might have permitted most of the things on this list. And it's certainly, if it's life-threatening, then it's not called cosmetic surgery. It's not called even maybe a plastic surgery. So this would include, for example, bariatric surgery, which is done for a certain level for cosmetic, but it's also done for health. So I think that the Kimak, all if not all, the poskim would permit a bariatric type of surgery, which is cosmetic in a certain nature. Limb saving, if a person, Rahman al-San, had some sort of congenital or traumatic injury, and you're saving the limb, even if it's not pikuach nefesh, it's permissible. If it's going to save functionality, if you do certain type of surgery, you'll have usage of the arm, as opposed to if you don't do it, so then also, kimat, if not all, would say it's mutter, vision saving, reconstructive surgery, Rahman al-San, after breast cancer or something like that, you're allowed to even tattoo according to most poskim for radiation, you're allowed to tattoo according to make more of a physiologically looking body, in terms of making an areola, in terms of making a nipple. There are halachic major poskim that permit these types of things. I'm not even aware of poskim that wouldn't permit this under normal reconstructive permission. We spoke about the psychological language for shiduchim. If there's a surgery that a woman feels is necessary, without going into why she feels it's necessary, should she feel it's necessary, never. It's a shame that such things are sometimes considered necessary. So from a halachic point of view, it would be permissible. And certainly if it's involving pain control or something like that. Where I think it's clearly prohibited, even according to the most makel of poskim, if there's no benefit to the patient. The physician says, $100, I need to practice doing a nose job. A person that really doesn't have a bad nose job. So even if it was not an ethical problem in the secular world, but doing in a study, some sort of a procedure like that, it would be obviously not allowed. If the person is nebuch psychologically ill, and they're doing things inappropriately, cutting themselves, so all sorts of things like that are definitely not allowed. If there's no real benefit to the procedure, a normal person wouldn't do this. If it was significantly dangerous, even though you're doing it for potential benefit, and again, if it's hashkafically inappropriate, it's going to lead a person to do various things that are usur because of this enhanced body, etc. So those are different types of shilas, and those would not be permitted under normal circumstances. But there's much more of a gray zone, and again, different poskim will tell you different things, is what about the person needs it for his job? Everybody is looking to be younger. You're an anchor person on the news, and normally when you hit 40, they get the 20-year-old to come in and take your place. So you want to stretch that. You want to look 20 for a couple of years longer. So for parnasa purposes, would it be allowed? So again, the poskim that would permit it for this. I asked this question specifically to Rav Shechter. He thought it would be acceptable for parnasa purposes as well. Social pressures. Everybody in the group's had it done. So you want to have it done. You don't really think you need it done, but everybody else is having it done, and you want to keep up with the Joneses. So again, I think it's very weak in that situation for a person. I think you're a poskim that might permit it, because you do want to have it done, but I think then it's a much more weaker situation. If it's not real psychological anguish, I think I'd look better. I think I would be happier. So then one has to really ask yourself, are these things appropriate or not? The last thing I just want to conclude is I asked Rav Shechter a number of interesting questions. I thought they were interesting to share them with you in terms of with the Olympics, for example, plastic surgery for an athlete. So we call that using various enhancements. Is it mutter for a person to take steroids from a halachic point of view if he wants to compete professionally? So I asked this to Rav Shechter, and he told me, he said if the risk was small enough, again, he's talking from a purely halachic point of view, he thought that it would be halachically acceptable, because this is somewhat for parnasa purposes, for a person to halachically take various types of enhancement drugs in order to improve their performance. Very surprising, but he added the caveat. He said that if they win anything, they have to give the money back, or they have to give the prize back, because they're being gonaded from somebody else who competed competitively and fairly. So from an issa point of view, he said, he didn't think it was an issa, but from a Geneva's das point of view, or a Geneva point of view, he said, but you have to then announce afterwards, but I cheated. So again, you ask a question, you have to know how to ask the question, because you can leave that conversation and say it's mutter to use a drug-enhancing performance drug, but it's also from the point of view that you want to win it, so you get the gold medal, but you have to give back the gold medal. You get a $250,000 gift, you stole it from the guy who came in number two. And then the last thing he said, Rav Shachter also said, he felt that this whole plastic surgery was also a machlokas between the Rav, Rav Yosheber Soloveitchik Zatzal, and his brother, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. And he felt that the Rav permitted it, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik did not permit it. So again, you have a great, great poskim that have weighed in on this matter. And Be'ezus Hashem, I hope people listen to the first part of the lecture as much as they maybe listen to the second part of the lecture. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Let's answer some questions.
One thing that I didn't see out there was, I know before World War I, many grown men either put a piece of their thing on the trigger finger or injected silicone into ankles so that combat would not fit over themselves so that they could avoid being drafted into the Tsar's army. How would that fit into this?
So I think in that situation, it would really be a question of pikuach nefashos. They're doing it really for... truly in front of you, a situation pikuach nefashos. So based upon that, on first blush, I would think that something like that is mutter. You have a raya to that from Bar Kokhba's army. The Gemara, the Yerushalmi, says that Bar Kokhba had 400,000 men in his army. The first 200,000 Marines that enlisted in his army, it said he had a test. He made them cut off their finger. If they could cut off the finger, it showed that they were strong people. And the Levim did the same idea. The Levim refused to go play their instruments for the Rishayim that destroyed the first base of Mikdash. So apparently none of the Mepharshim there say that there was a problem with either Bar Kokhba's people cutting off the finger. The rabbis came to him and said, you're hurting people, you shouldn't do it, but they didn't say it's asur. And likewise, by Levim, it doesn't say when they cut off their fingers that it's asur. So I would agree, again, first blush, I never saw this question answered by anybody else, and maybe somebody else would like to comment otherwise, but on first blush, it would seem to me that that would fall into the gather of pikuach nefashos. They're doing it to save their lives, and certainly one's allowed to undergo an operation for a suffix pikuach nefashos. So I would think that that would be acceptable.
You mentioned last night that you don't like calling Jewish medical ethics, like calling Jewish medical halacha, because, well, it's not really ethics, it's halacha, which is. But I heard once that Jewish medical ethics is everything after you decide the halacha of what's permissible and what's prohibited. Once you know what you can do and what you can't do, the Jewish medical ethics is, from a Jewish point of view, okay, now what do we? What's right to do? What should I mean? I, as a doctor, as a physician,
I would somewhat respectfully disagree. I hope it wasn't the great person that told you that I'm disagreeing with. I hope it was just an average person. I never argue with an Adam Gadol. I think Laniyaz Dati, the Hashkafa that I've been brought up with, is that everything in life is a halachic question. I was taught by my Rebbeim that everything you do either moves you forward or moves you back. The very few things that move you sideways. Very few things that aren't going to spiritually increase your spirituality or decrease your spirituality. So I don't view many things in life as being neutral. Having said that, there are some things in life that are, you know, do I want to eat the chicken or do I want to eat the meat? It's not a halachic question unless it happens to be like I spoke about yesterday in the Pasha class, the Yotzei Basar, the mitzvah of eating basar with chicken versus fish versus something like that. So then everything becomes a halachic question. But there are some things in life. Do I want to play basketball? I want to play baseball for the Shmartim Odis Nafsho Seichem. So I think a person has some leniencies to do what he would like. I don't view that as ethics. I view that as a person making a decision, what is going to improve him as an individual human being or not going to drag him down. if you want to put that under the category of hashkafa, the way you're describing maybe ethics is more of a hashkafic approach, the person has to have a derech in life. He has to have a mora hora that teaches him how he should conduct himself in life, what he should do with his free time, what he should do when he's not osek with a pure mitzvah. So in that respect, if you want to call that ethics, I would call that more hashkafa. So yeah, I would agree with that aspect. But whether a person should have plastic surgery or not done on them, I think a person should ask a rav and follow the psak of the rav, and not just take out a Chalkus Yaakov or take out a Tzitz Eliezer and say, well, that's what he says, so therefore that's what I'm going to do. You really need a hadrach in life. You need to ask your rav.
Question, Mark?
Yeah. So, the answer to the
reason
for example, that means just or are they doing it one or two? So that they go to do the step of repair and they happen to do both jobs at the same time.
So yeah,
do this operation now or do you do it later? You can say for an optical example of, you know, someone has doesn't have a acute glaucoma now, but you only do laser procedure on the eye now so that you don't end up having to have an emergency procedure later.
You're asking a very good question, but I think the answer is really within the question. What is your real reason for doing it? You have to be honest with yourself. You have to be honest with the post that you're asking the question to. The person has a deviated septum, and they're having trouble breathing. It's uncomfortable for them. And it also would look a lot better if it was corrected. So then they have to ask themselves, why are they doing it? Is it because of the breathing problem? Is it because of the appearance problem? And they have... So that's preventative medicine. Is a person allowed to undergo a bariatric procedure, for example, because they're right now they're overweight, but right now they haven't had their heart attack yet. Right now they haven't had their sequelae of being morbidly obese. So the answer is clearly yes. Halachically speaking, a person is allowed to take preventative measures, even if they're somewhat dangerous for potentially putting somebody at risk for a chayisha right now, in order to have a much longer period of time. Can a person go to cabbage? Can they undergo any specific procedure, a valve replacement? There's a 2% mortality on the table now. But if he doesn't have it, he'll die in 5 years. If he does have it, he'll die in 25 years. So clearly halacha allows something like that. So with all of these questions, I think the person has to be honest with themselves and honest with the posek. Now, if it's just purely for cosmetic purposes, it doesn't mean that it's also. There are many, many poskim that would allow it, depending on the situation. But at least it has to be recognized that that's why you're doing it. Once you start adding or introducing true medical indications, that's a totally different shayla. And that shayla is much more easy. The Tzitz Eliezer would also permit you to have a nose job if the person can't breathe. But the Tzitz Eliezer would not permit you to have a nose job if it was purely for cosmetic purposes.
Less of an issue with Botox than there is with surgery,
So I asked this question to Rav Schechter as well, and he felt that it's bloodless. Not that Botox is necessarily bloodless, but he said if it's not a bloody procedure, he doesn't think it even halachically falls within the gather of Chavallah. Chavallah, for example, on Shabbos, Hilchos Shabbos, is a prohibition making a black and blue off punching somebody. Okay? For a parent, there's an issa, Rahmanul Islam, if you punch somebody. So a parent, if you raise a black and blue mark, it's a chiv of capital crime. But if you hit them, you don't make a black and blue mark, both in Shabbos and with a parent, Rahmanul Islam, it wouldn't necessarily be a capital crime. It'd still be prohibited, but it wouldn't necessarily involve a capital crime. So if you did laser surgery, yes, it's specifically about LASIK surgery. You do with the eye for correcting refraction. He didn't think there was anything halachically wrong with it. And the same question, are you allowed to wear glasses? Glasses is a type of plastic surgery. Putting a hearing aid in is a type of corrective type of surgery. So the psak was, that's not even a question. Absolutely permissible.
Thank you very much. Okay, so we'll take a 15-minute break now for whatever, and we'll reconvene. Hello, can I get your attention? This is the last opportunity if anyone wants to purchase any of the books that are outside. The Sfarim are $18. The book in English is $15. And there's also Rabbi Shabtai's book. How much is your book? $15 as well. The announcement for the Out of the Ashes conference, the flyers are out, and your evaluations and certificates are available as soon as I get them.
Thank you very much.
Okay. You're out of here?
Yeah, I'm out of here.
Okay.
It's really a pleasure. Be in touch.
Please do, okay?
And, hopefully 10 years down the line, you'll find this giant medical ethics center that I was a big part of.
Thank you.
Okay, I think we're going to restart, resume. Can somebody just mention to the people outside that we're going to get started? It's always the problem of having a break. Yeah, I'll lose that momentum. Yeah. Okay, we'll get started. It's a no-win situation. Trust me, I've been doing it for years.
No.
Give it to you,
Your name's on my paper.
My name's on. Oh, really?
I think your wife.
Oh, yeah? Okay, so who's booked this before? I was signed for this. Brother Steinberg? Okay. Sure. Just, yeah. I'll do it.
Okay. Is that the right place?
Yeah.
She's all paid with Friday.
I'm sorry?
She's all paid with Friday.
Oh, okay. That worked out. Okay. So maybe start and just, you know, and where's the break? The food break? Is it all the way down or all the way to the other side? Not enough yetis in the world. That's the problem.
Well, that would be big. Sorry.
There's not enough yetis in the world. I organized my run around to the hospital. It's like nothing.
I'm on the board.
I'm telling you, yetis.
They start.
There's nothing that, you know.
No one's in the meeting. One person's in the meeting.
That's what it is.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to we'll resume. So continuing on the theme of the elective medicine. So once the shidduch has been arranged and the surgery has been successful, we have to move on to more artificial ways of having children. And so now we have octomom and the problems that we heard on Thursday evening when we started the conference. So we've come full circle. So Rabbi Shaptaf, I can have you come back and help deal with octomom.
So thank you very much. Again, I just want to echo all the previous speakers' thanks to all the organizers, Rabbi Kelman, Dr. Friedman. It's really a privilege for me to be here to be able to learn Torah with everybody together. I know I've gained from it, and this was a really wonderful opportunity, and I thank you again for it. So we talk about fetal reduction. Fetal reduction, just to define it, is the selective abortion of one or more fetuses in women carrying multiple fetuses. And I think it's actually kind of interesting that it's put into the elective medicine module, because there are different types of reductions that we do, and or not that we do, we should do, that we can do, and a lot of it depends on why we do them, and only some of them would seem to be elective. But we'll talk about the elective ones first, and we'll continue to do some of the other ones, which I don't necessarily consider to be elective. So there are the completely elective procedures, where there is no medical indication whatsoever. And then there are other cases of where there's danger to the mother, or danger, how serious a risk, or a danger and a risk of danger to the fetuses. So let's talk about the we'll talk about the elective ones first, and then we'll continue to the more dangerous ones. So first, as is true with all the presentations this morning, it's even more true here. This is the discussion of fetal reduction of abortion is very complicated in the halakhic literature. We're going to try to do it in 23 more minutes, and I'm not going to pretend to cover all the bases. I'm only going to give highlights and an outline. So even more so in this case, if it ever comes down to it, make sure you consult with a competent Orthodox rabbi who has a lot of years to mind. Okay, so in terms of completely elective procedures, there was an article in New York Times Magazine last August about the 2-1 pregnancy. These are women who were carrying twins and wanted to reduce to one. And why did they want to reduce to one? So the article was not short on reasons. Spending the whole gamut, none of which were medical. Talking about indications, there is no risk to the mother, there is no risk to the fetuses. But there are a number of reasons, and they're not even worth repeating. But the article was several pages long, listing very different reasons, listing very different motivations. We're not talking about any case here where there's a danger to the mother, there's no danger to the fetuses. The fetuses, according to every statistic, should be born healthy, the woman should maintain her health, and should be no risk whatsoever. So I think this is a very simple case. According to halacha, any procedure that is complete, any fetal reduction that is completely elective is completely forbidden. Abortion is forbidden according to halacha. There is no difference between fetal reduction and a regular case of abortion in this case. We'll talk about other cases in a moment. But when it's completely elective, again, no medical indication for the mother, no medical indication for the fetuses, it's the same as any abortion case. Because in halacha, we're concerned with the action. The action is selectively aborting one of the fetuses. This article tries to proceed to show the little different motivations in abortion. Abortion, well, the mother doesn't want to have any children. Here she's trying to have children. But in halacha, the practical aspects of it are the same. In the end, what we're doing is we're selectively aborting one of the fetuses. And again, without any indication medical for the mother or the fetuses, it should be completely forbidden. And so what we need to do, though, is try to analyze. So that's not always the case. Not every case is completely elective, although this article was focusing on these completely elective cases. We need to find out, well, what is the nature of this prohibition? We need to figure out where and when does it apply, because not every prohibition spans the gamut of all actions in halacha. Certain will have, there may be exceptions to this rule depending on the circumstances. Again, not when they're completely elective, but life is complicated and we'll have different factors coming into consideration. And so we have the different types of reduction. Again, we're not going to discuss the completely elective again because I think the completely elective is very simple. It's a standard case of abortion according to halacha and would be forbidden. What I'd like to discuss is now when there are cases of danger to the mother's life. And every pregnancy is dangerous. A woman who's not pregnant has a lower risk of death than a woman who is pregnant. Pregnancy presents a dangerous situation, circumstance for the mother. It's not terribly dangerous, but it's it's somewhat dangerous, but yet we consider it normal. We discussed previously, is there a prohibition to put yourself in a place of danger? It's perfectly permitted for a woman to get pregnant. In fact, there's a mitzvah that they get pregnant. The mitzvah doesn't devolve upon the woman, indeed. It devolves upon the man. So the woman has to opt in. Right? The mitzvah to have children is a mitzvah on the man, according to how we pass him. The woman has to opt in. So how could she opt in into a dangerous procedure? How could she put herself in a dangerous situation? So the answer is, it's just not that dangerous for a variety of reasons. But nonetheless, statistically, it's true. So, and it makes sense, and it's true, that the more fetuses a woman's carrying, the more dangerous it is. The question is, how dangerous? We'll show some data in a little bit. So just briefly, how many is too many? It's hard to give a straight answer. We all know about the Octo mom that Dr. Friedman mentioned. She had 8 children. Last I checked, she was in the news, I think, a week or two ago. She seems to be doing just fine. Having a little bit monetary issues, but she's doing okay. Her babies are all alive and well. They're all still young, so they may have yet learning disabilities, but they're physically all healthy. None are connected to any machinery to live. And so it's hard to say how many is too many on an objective level. However, there are specific circumstances for each woman. Each woman is different. Each woman's anatomy is different. Each woman's physiology is different. Each woman's medical comorbidities are different. And so for each woman, there may be an answer. For this woman, it might be 2. For this woman, it might be 8. For some women, it might be 10, 12, 15. I always assumed that 8 was dangerous. And 8, you know, a woman would certainly die with 8, but apparently we all know that's not true. It's not certainly. It might be likely. This woman, this Suleiman is doing just fine. So it's more each specific circumstances. And it's then again hard to say that they were going to have a certainty anymore. Certainly with, we know that 8 just happened, and I think we always thought that so many was certainly going to kill the mother, and therefore the reductions were all done. And so there's very little data on this. But there's a statistical odds, but it's not very frequent. But let's discuss what would be the case, because that'll help us understand the halakha more. Let's say that the multiple gestations, the woman carrying many fetuses, will cause her death. If she continues with this pregnancy, she's now 3 months pregnant, she had the 20-week sonogram, I think, and they discover that she's carrying 10 fetuses. We're not going to discuss how they got there and whether that was appropriate or not, but let's say she's carrying 8 or more fetuses, and it is putting her life at risk because of her specific circumstances, so what do we do? So this is already discussed in the Mishnah. The Mishnah says that if the laboring woman is experiencing a life-threatening emergency, we sacrifice the baby to save the mother's life. Because we know that in halakha, the woman's life comes first ahead of the baby's. However, the Mishnah continues that once the child emerges from the mother, and the mother's life is still in danger, but once the baby is emerged, we no longer can sacrifice the baby to save the mother. So it's clear, though, that so long as the baby is not considered to be born before it emerges, whatever the prohibition is against abortion that we said is clear according to all the poskim, it's definitely forbidden. Whatever the prohibition is, it's set aside to save the life of the mother. So if the mother's life is in danger, whatever that prohibition in general is, when her life is not in danger, it's set aside when her life is in danger. So if it was if it was a prohibition of eating treif, if she needs to eat treif to save her life, we certainly allow anybody, certainly a pregnant woman, to eat treif to save her life. She needs to not fast on Yom Kippur to save her life. Then certainly we would encourage her, and we would not let her fast on Yom Kippur if it was to save her life. According to the way that we pass, and according to Shmir Shabbos, we would say the same thing about the baby. If fasting on Yom Kippur will certainly cause the baby's death, or even might cause the baby's demise, the fetus, we would also allow her, we would force her, I think, according to Shmir Shabbos, to violate Yom Kippur, to eat treif, to do whatever is necessary to save her life. It sounds like every other prohibition in the Torah. Problem is that it's not so clear, because once the baby comes out, it becomes forbidden. So what happens? What change happens? So again, as I mentioned, this is a discussion in the Rishonim, in the Achronim, in the modern Poskim, in the early Poskim. This is a discussion that stems a lot of Torah, so we're going to simplify it a little bit, trying to figure out what is the prohibition. And then, as I mentioned before, that almost every prohibition is set aside for the sake of Pikuach Nefesh. So this is the case of Pikuach Nefesh. We artificially created a case of Pikuach Nefesh. The mother is certainly going to die if she carries these babies to term. So it's a case of Pikuach Nefesh. So we know that Pikuach Nefesh is always trumps every prohibition except for murder, idolatry, and illicit relationships. So it would sound like, well, it definitely doesn't even, I wouldn't think it was idolatry or illicit relationships. The only question I would have is this murder? And it sounds like it's not. Because if it was murder, I'm not allowed to murder someone to save somebody else. So it sounds like, but here I can sacrifice the baby to save the mother. The problem is that once the baby comes out, then the Mishnah is clear that you can't sacrifice the baby to save the mother, and it's clear that it is murder. So what changes when the baby comes out? Does the prohibition change? And before it was something else, and now it's murder? Or do we say, no, the prohibition was the same, it's just the baby's status changed. And maybe it was murder before, but it was a murder that was permissible, and now it became a murder that was prohibited. And there's going to be differences in how we understand that depending on, and how we actually apply this halacha lemaisa. So what is this prohibition going to be? And again, simplifying this a lot, we're going to make it into a two-way machlokas. Rav Moshe Feinstein understood that, based on the Rambam, that the prohibition of abortion is murder. Abortion is murder, according to Rav Moshe Feinstein, very clearly. It doesn't entail capital punishment for Yisrael. I would entail capital punishment for Ben Noach. But it is a prohibition of murder. And so, okay. So if it's prohibition of murder, I just got through saying that any prohibition we set aside for people have it except for murder, so the mission is clear that we set it aside. So why in the world would we set murder aside here? Why would we allow, this mission is talking about one baby, but if the baby's putting the mother's life in danger, why would we allow sacrificing the baby to save the mother? It doesn't make sense. So he says, well, I'm wrong. Okay. Murder is not always prohibited to save a life. Sometimes we permit murder to save a life. The other Mishnayos are pretty clear that there's a notion of rodef. A rodef is someone who's pursuing somebody else. So if Reuven is running after Shimon to kill him, we, as bystanders, are allowed and even have a mitzvah to kill Reuven. You're not allowed to run after somebody to kill him. Once you're a rodef, you've given up your rights to life, effectively, and I'm allowed to kill you, and I have a mitzvah to kill you to prevent you from killing somebody else. So he says, okay, so the baby is being rodef the mother. He's putting the mother's life in danger. So the baby's putting the mother's life in danger, so then certainly he's a rodef. And just like every other rodef, you can kill the baby to save the mother. Okay, so that only helps for the first half of the mission. The second half of the mission doesn't make sense. When the baby comes out, though, he's still putting the mother's life in danger. So why can't you kill the baby then? So the Gemara there says, Mishmaya karad filei. From the Shamayim, the baby's not actually rodef the mother, it's Mishmaya karad filei. It's from the Shamayim. Or the Rambam says, Zeu tivo shalolam. That's a natural course of things. So the baby comes out, he's not actually being a rodef. Whatever that means, the baby's not doing anything different than when he was out than when he was in. So why do you say when he was out that he is a rodef and you say when he's inside, he's a rodef, when he's outside, he's not a rodef? It's very hard to know. So Rav Moshe, understanding based on the Yerushalmi, says, you know what really the situation is that they're both rodef each other. The baby's being rodef the mother, he's trying to kill the mother. And the mother's being rodef the baby. She doesn't want to have this child because it's going to kill her. So they're being rodef each other. So what would be the din in that case? So that makes it even worse, you'd think. If two people are having a duel, and they're both being rodef each other, I'm not allowed to intervene. I don't know. They're both being rodef each other. If I save him, then how do I know who to save? I'm not allowed to intervene. So he says, that's the situation when the baby's born. When the baby's born, they're being rodef each other, and I'm not allowed to intervene. When the baby's still inside, they're also being rodef each other, but I am allowed to intervene. He says, the difference is that when the baby's inside, the baby's a bigger rodef. A bigger rodef. He says, well, the mother's a living person. She has a full nefesh. She's a living person. The baby is still a fetus. He has a lower status. And therefore, she's being rodef a lower status, and he's being rodef a larger status person. And it's that advantage that the mother has over him that the baby's being rodef, that she's not. So the baby is a bigger rodef than she is, and therefore, it's not an equal duel. They're not on equal footing. I'm allowed to sacrifice the baby, who's the bigger rodef, to save the mother. Once the baby's born, they're on equal footing, they're being rodef each other equally, and they're having a duel, and I can't intervene. The Tzitz Eliezer, however, understands things completely differently. He says that if there is a prohibition min HaTorah, if there is a prohibition in the min HaTorah, it's one of chavala, like we just heard about, of damaging or wounding. He says it's not murder. He says even in the Rambam, he has a way to get out of the Rambam. I'm not going to talk about that now. He thinks nobody believes it's murder. None of the Rishonim believe it's murder. Even the Rambam, who sounds like it's not. And he says, the fetus is not an independent being. You can't murder part of a person. And he says, irrespective, if in Talmudic parlance we would say, uber yerach imo, uber lav yerach imo, it doesn't matter if you consider the baby to be an organic part of the mother or not an organic part of the mother for halakhic purposes, it's still wounding. And it's wounding of the mother. And it's a little bit similar to cosmetic surgery now. So the person's life is in danger, and I have to wound myself to save myself. So if I need an amputation to save my life, certainly we're going to allow the amputation. It's just a prohibition of Kabbalah, of wounding, to save my life. So too with the woman. It's a prohibition of wounding the mother. The fetus is part of the mother, whether Uber Yerachim or Belav Yerachim, not relevant right now. Practically, it's part of the mother. And therefore, you're allowed to wound, the woman's allowed to wound herself. She might have to wound herself in order to save her own life. So, getting back to the issues of the reduction now, how does that come into play? So we have a danger to the mother's life. So the Mishnah is clear. Danger to the mother's life, we can sacrifice the babies. The baby or the babies. Right? That's clear in the Mishnah. The Mishnah says it's okay. The reasoning is going to be different. Right? The Rav Moshe says that the reasoning is because the babies are bigger rodim. The baby or babies are being rodim, that advantage that she has over them. And the Mishnah Eliezer argues, no, that it's just Chavalah, but it's Chavalah for the sake of saving your own life, and therefore it's going to be permissible. It may have differences, however, for the types of danger that the mother is in. So, is she certainly going to die from carrying all these babies, or is she only possibly going to die? I'm not an obstetrician. I would venture to say that it's going to be very hard to say she's certainly going to die. Certainly now, when we know the case of 8, she's fine. I guess it would depending on each woman's circumstances, but is she certainly going to die or only possibly going to die? And Rav Moshe Feinstein writes very clearly, it has to be karov levada. It has to be almost an absolute certainty that she's going to die. Otherwise, he's not willing to consider the baby to be a big erotic. Not erotic at all. If she's not certainly going to die, Rav Moshe was not comfortable allowing this, and therefore, if she's not certainly going to die, he's not going to allow the abortion or the selective reduction. The Tzitz Eliezer is taking a different perspective. He's saying, if anything, it's chavala. If it's chavala, it's wounding. I'm allowed to wound myself, even for the possible. I don't have to be certain that I'm going to die in order to wound myself. Maybe the gangrene will kill me, maybe it won't. But I'm still allowed to take that procedure to be chovel in myself, to wound myself, to prevent the possibility of me dying as well. And it doesn't make a difference that we're talking about a baby or my leg, because it's all chavala in the Tzitz Eliezer's eyes. An additional factor might be, just mention it here, is what is causing the risk to the mother? Is it the pregnancy itself, carrying the 10, 12, 15 babies that's causing the risk to the mother? Or is something else causing the risk? So a sad case, which hopefully doesn't come up very often, a woman who's pregnant and finds out she has cancer. And so she needs to have chemotherapy. And if she waits, she's in her third month, if she waits this extra 6 months until she has the baby, she's delaying treatment and potentially putting her life in danger. Now the baby's not putting her life in danger, but she can't get chemotherapy while she's pregnant. Not only will it kill the baby, which we'll talk about separately, but it's dangerous to get chemotherapy while you're pregnant. And so, is the baby in this case, I think the Tzitz Eliezer would say, okay, that's fine. You're doing chavala. Why? Because it might be beneficial for me to have chemotherapy right now. According to Rav Moshe, I'm not as clear. According to Rav Moshe, would you consider the baby to be a rodape in this case, or not a rodape in this case? The baby is not putting the mother's life in danger, but he is preventing her from getting life-saving treatment, and an issue for another time, but something definitely to think about. So, what's the data? Are mothers' lives put in danger by this? And do multifetal pregnancies cause death? And let's say, for my analysis of this, the data is bad. Much of the data is old, and does not include modern obstetric care that we can provide in 2012. Today, we can treat women a lot better than we could have in 1960, when some of this data is they're quoting from, in the 1970s, and the data is just not the best. And there are statistical likelihoods, but the data is not very good. One of the ACOG, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, recommendations, I think, was above 4, definitely do it. Or definitely recommend it. I don't think we certainly can't force it. But above 4, definitely recommend it, definitely try to persuade the woman to do it, because of the concern for maternal death. And they are basing it on a bunch of studies, but again, they're not very, very good. So let's just look at some actual data quickly. So this is a paper from Obstetrics and Gynecology in 2006. It's comparing the mortality of the woman for 100,000 births. And so, right, maternal mortality per 100,000 births. And so the mortality ratio that they show for a singleton pregnancy is 5.8 women per 100,000 live births. And for a multifetal pregnancy of 2 or more, it's 20.8 per 100,000 births. Now, just realize they're very, very low numbers. They're about 20 in 100,000 births. But the difference is a little bit stark. It's 3 to 4 times the amount. The difference is great, but ultimately the absolute risk is quite low. But again, this study is based on so many different assumptions. you could read through the materials and methods, and it's just 3 pages of all the assumptions that they're making. A similar French study tried to prove that from, I'm not a statistician, not an epidemiologist, but from a statistical perspective, in order to have a study, this is showing a 3 to 4 times difference. In order to show a 2 times difference, you would have to have, in France, given their numbers, 500 maternal deaths a year to even show a double difference, which, thankfully, in France, we don't have that. Even in the United States, which we have many more of the population of France, we don't have 500 maternal deaths a year. In order to have an actual statistically valid showing of at least double the risk. So again, this is based on a lot of assumptions. So much so that if you continue to look at the data, it's even more troubling. If you look at so with age, the risk gets higher. So if you look at white women 30 years and older, the multifetal mortality risk for the mother is 20.1 per 100,000 women. So you're saying, well, the risk of a singleton pregnancy was 5.8, so 20.1 sounds significant, and if we're going to consider that to be a risk for the mother, that we should consider fetal reduction, then we have to look at the next part of the paper, the next part of the data, that for an African American woman, 30 years and older, carrying a single pregnancy, the mortality risk is even higher than for a white woman 30 years and older carrying a multifetal pregnancy. It's 28.2 for an African American woman over the age of 30 carrying a single pregnancy. So if we're going to take the risk to the mother so significantly of 20.2 before, 20.8 of carrying a multifetal pregnancy, and say that's a significant risk for the mother, then we should also be willing to abort, for maternal indications, every African American woman over the age 30 carrying a single pregnancy, which I don't believe to be reasonable. I don't think that's reasonable. I'm not suggesting we do that, God forbid. I'm just suggesting that if you look at these numbers, that's not reasonable. So I don't think these numbers are significant enough, even though the difference seems high. That's not something that we should take very seriously. So I'd like to talk about now the danger to the fetuses. And how would that work out based on what we know from the halacha? So this is unfortunately more frequent, the danger to the fetuses. Normally we can keep the mother alive and healthy, and especially with modern obstetrical care. And so let's talk about, first of all, we have different cases. We can have all the fetuses are certainly going to die. Some of them will die, or none of them will die, but some might be impaired. So all of them will die presents a halachically simpler case. Again, why this should happen would depend, again, on specific circumstances, but let's assume it's true. There's, again, very little actual data on it. I tried looking for it. I couldn't find data really past 1990, and I wasn't willing to go before that, because, again, obstetric care has changed. And so how is this going to work according to both the different opinions of Rav Moshe Feinstein and Cicely Ezer? So Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein addresses this question head-on. He takes the perspective that abortion is murder. And if abortion is murder, then why do we allow it in the Mishnah's case? Because it's the risk of the mother's life, and the mother's life trumps the life of the fetus. So here there's no risk for the mother's life. We're assuming, again, no risk for the mother's life. So it sounds like it should be prohibited to sacrifice any of the babies, because it's considered to be murder, and the only reason you could do it is to save the mother. And here we're not saving the mother. That's the case we created. We're not saving the mother. We're saving other fetuses. The only case is to save the mother. So here he says, it sounds like it should be prohibited. He says, but there's another case of an exception to murder. This is in the following case. The Tosefta in Trumos discusses, let's say, a band of robbers, a band of thieves, a bandit surrounds a group of people and says, "Tunu lanu echad mikem, give us one of you and we'll kill him, or we'll kill the whole group." Everyone's familiar with the conclusion of that Tosefta is, you're not allowed to give him up. Everyone should die and not give one up. Rav Zilberstein takes a different interpretation, and he says, "Well, no, that's not talking about a case where everyone will certainly die, but where everyone will certainly die, based on the Lechem Mishnah, he says, where everyone in that group will certainly die, no matter what, you can give up one. If giving up one will save everybody in the group, certainly, everyone is certainly going to die, you can give up that one." So he says, "Well, that's the same thing here. If we have a case where all the fetuses are going to die, whatever the prohibition is, even if it's prohibition of murder." Well, you're allowed to give up one to save the rest of the fetuses. So even though the prohibition is murder, we're allowed to do it because we're certain that all the fetuses are going to die. And he repeats that in 3 different places. He has this in a new sefer where he is Shiurei Torah L'Rofim. He collects all of his... Rav Zilberstein is a prolific writer. And he's written in various different journals and articles, and I have photocopies all over my house, but now he published them in the 5-volume set, so it's all together. So he has all of these tshuvas together. And he says, well, that's only true so long as the babies are certainly going to die. All of them are certainly going to die. And you can only reduce to the number that they're all no longer certainly going to die. But even though the prohibition is that of murder, it's certainly going to be permitted in this case because it's okay, because they're all going to die. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, however, is quoted as disagreeing with that approach. He says, we don't pass in that way in the Tosefta and Trumos, and if I don't care that they were all going to die, you're not allowed to sacrifice one to save everybody else. That's just not true. We don't pass in like that Tosefta and Trumos. And he says you can never commit murder, and so that's not going to be okay. Rav Shlomo Zalman, as Dr. Steinberg was trying to explain yesterday, doesn't hold that abortion is murder per se, but he holds that it's more than Chavala. So it's more than Chavala, but less than murder, and we're going to allow it to save the mother's life again. So here we're not saving the mother's life. So why is it going to be permitted, whatever the prohibition is, to selectively reduce, to pit one fetus against another? So he says, well, there's another exception. Sounds like murder is like this free-for-all. We're reading a lot of exceptions to it. He says the prohibition of abortion is on a baby that has the potential to live. If they're all going to die, a baby that's doomed to die in utero is called a nafel. A nafel is not going to live at all. So there's no prohibition of killing a nafel at all. So long as we know that this baby, or all of these babies, are going to die, no matter what we do, then they're a nafel. And there's no prohibition of murder, there's no prohibition of abortion to abort a baby who's not going to make it anyway. And therefore, it makes sense that you can abort, selectively abort, until the point where you're not certain they're going to die anymore. And therefore, even though he thinks it's not murder, but it's still a significant power prohibition, and we're not saving the mother's life, because they're nephilim, each one's a nephil, we can sacrifice them. So the question gets a little bit more complicated, though, when only some will live. And now, when some will live, right, we have the woman's carrying 12 or 15 again, because I just have to say more than 8. So, well, some will die, or we know which ones will, and we know, or perhaps we don't know which ones will. Sometimes we know that out of the 12, 15, some are just have malformations in them, and they're not going to make it. So, it may make a difference, according to what we said before. It would sound like a point from Shlomo Zalman, if we know which fetuses are not going to make it, so there's no prohibition of abortion in the nephil. So there's no prohibition to selectively reduce those children. However, if we don't know, we said there are 10, and this woman can only hold 4, and we know that 6 aren't going to make it, but we don't know which, it's going to be a lot harder to say. We don't know which 6 are going to make it, which 4 are going to make it, I mean. We don't know which are going to make it. It's hard to pin down to say any of them are in the nephilim at this point. It's a little bit more complicated. Can we consider any of them to be a rodeif? Well, if we don't do anything, it's a little bit more complicated. If we don't do anything, let's say 3 will live. If we do something, we can get 4 to live, but we don't know which one. It doesn't matter which we choose. It's a little bit more complicated. I would venture to say, the Tzitzit Eliezer doesn't address this directly, but I would venture to say that the Tzitzit Eliezer would allow it. The Tzitzit Eliezer would say, well, I can wound myself for the potential of enhancing another part of myself. So I can wound myself in one of my fetuses to save another one of the fetuses. It would be the same between 2 different hands or a foot in the hand. According to the Tzitzit Eliezer, I'm allowed to wound myself for the potential of saving another part of my body, even though I can't specify which part. It would be very hard to say, according to Rav Moshe Feinstein, if it's a prohibition of murder, how can I say one's a bigger rodeif than another? It's a little bit more complicated. There is perhaps a way of getting, there are other ways of saying this, according to Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, there might be a way of getting around it. I don't want to go into that right now, even if you decide it's murder. But I would think that according to Rav Moshe Feinstein, all of my rabbis I've spoken to, they think, whether they cost like Rav Moshe Feinstein, that's a different question. But according to Rav Moshe Feinstein, that this would be a little bit more problematic. And then there's the most prevalent case that I've seen in the literature of none will die. Woman's carrying 5, and we think that the woman will make it, we think that the fetuses will make it, but the likelihood is with 5, they're going to be born prematurely, and premature infants carry a higher risk of a lot of different types of disabilities. And it's a pretty high risk, depending on how many she has and how premature they're born, and there could be other inherent risks in just the 5 themselves. And so this is unfortunately more common. And there are a lot of there are a lot of factors to consider with why this should happen, and each is going to be a case-by-case basis. Chorionicity, apparently, is one of the big factors, how many fetuses are actually from each chorion on that itself. And so what would we do in this case? So, again, the Tzitzit Eliezer addresses this point head-on in one of his later tshuvos, in Chelek Kef and Chelek Kaf. And he says, and I think perhaps predictively, as what we understood now, he permits it. And I think it's characteristically, because if he thinks it's wounding, so the question is, can I wound myself to enhance the function and prevent a disability? I'm not going to lose my other hand. I'm not going to lose the function of my hand if I don't cut off my finger, but I'll enhance its functionality, or I'll prevent a disability to it. And he says that you can wound in that case. And you have to understand, building up what Rabbi Glatt said, the Tzitzit Eliezer not only is against cosmetic surgery for endoscopic reasons, he thinks it's Chavala. And he takes Chavala very seriously, so much so that he's prohibiting cosmetic surgery both on endoscopic and halakhic reasons. Kabbalah is, according to the Sifrei Ezer, he's one of the ones who takes Kabbalah the most seriously, perhaps, out of everybody else. So he's saying, though, but to enhance your own functionality, to prevent a disability, we're going to allow Kabbalah. So again, if the woman's carrying 10 and sacrificing some will enhance the viability, enhance the health of the other ones, not necessarily the viability, but the health of the other babies, then that's something that's going to be permissible according to the Tzitz Eliezer. I would venture to say again, Rav Moshe Feinstein doesn't address this head on, but he would not be able to permit it because he thinks it's a case of murder. We're only allowing a case of rodeif. These are not nephalim. These are viable babies. They might be ill, they might be disabled, but he's not going to allow sacrificing them. I'd just like to end with a piece from the Tzitz Eliezer inside. He has the most lenient approach to abortion, but at the end of his tshuva, he quotes a Zohar, and he says, I just want to read it because it's important. Even though he's advocating, now he's permitting, this is a tshuva where he's permitting many, many abortions. And he says, Kol b'nei Yisrael muzharim b'azhara chamura. Everyone is warned with a strict warning. Lo linhog kol utros b'afsakas ha'herayon. Not to act frivolously. They have to take everything. This is a serious question. And no matter how we end up paskening, we have to weigh all the factors and not be flippant about it. There's a tremendous responsibility both on the one who's asking and on the one who's being asked. And he continues, and Yisrael Kadoshim Hema, and he assumes we'll do the right thing. But this is coming from the person who's permitting most of the... He's being the most lenient position here. But nonetheless, even if we're going to take a lenient position, it still demands a thoughtful and attitude and a thoughtful consideration. So it depends on why, again, if there's a risk to the mother, so we're assuming they're all putting the mother at risk, they're all considered roadfim. So if they're all considered roadfim, it wouldn't matter. Most posting would suggest seeing if one has less chance of living than the other ones. Otherwise, I think this is the official ACOG recommendations, whichever is easier, practically, technically, for the doctor to pull off, because the procedure has its risks. There are spontaneous abortions from reduction procedures. It's not high, but they try to reduce one or two, and the woman ends up losing all of them. So there are better techniques and worse techniques, but if they're all considered roadkill, then there wouldn't be a problem of choosing, according to what's the posting.
In a monochoriotic monomamniotic twin pregnancy, where there's a high risk of intrauterine fetal demise if allowed to go to term, how would Moshe deal with this issue? Because really, they're roadkill one against another. So would he permit
the selective reduction in skills? So the way I understood Rav Moshe, I didn't think so. I checked with my Rebbeim, who again don't necessarily pass him like Rav Moshe, but that it wouldn't be permissible. There are other approaches to, even those who, like I just mentioned, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. So Rav Chaim has a piece in his Sefer about it, and he has other pieces about it, and they try to understand exactly what he was saying, but it could be that even according to him, that the reason... So normally we can't sacrifice one person to save another because we're saying, my chazis. How do you know that his blood is redder than yours? So, okay, it could be that what Reb Chaim is saying is a prohibition of murder, but there's no problem with my chazis by a fetus. No, I can tell. His blood's redder because the mother has a nefesh and he doesn't have a nefesh, and therefore we don't say my chazis. So the question is, why not? Is it only when we're playing the fetus in relation to the mother? Or is it, no, it's an objective status of the fetus. So if it's playing the fetus in relation to the mother, and only as regards the mother, I don't say my cousins, so then I think it would be prohibited here. But if it's an objective status on the fetus, that a fetus just doesn't have that quality, so then, yeah, you would be able to choose between the fetuses, even though the prohibition would be murder. That's very speculative in Reb Chaim, but I think it's possible.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure to call the master, the PowerPoint master, Rabbi Dr. Benny, and we'll be doing Lo Tamo Lo Dam Re'echa.
It's all continued. Oh, it's all continued on? for the last time.
I think this is it.
Huh?
And then I think it's continued.
Okay. Just have a minute. Is he here? You will tell him. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I would like to open with a slide which I have for Torah in Motion. I don't see Rabbi Jay and Ilana, but I would like to ask. I will show it to him afterwards. I wanted to know where is Torah in Motion Midoraita. And I found a clear pasuk which is very, very clear, and I think the best to perform that and to apply that is Rabbi Jay, his wife, Dr. Friedman and his wife, and the whole team who is doing that. It says in the Torah, when you do the Aron, you have to build the Aron HaKodesh with Yuv Habadim Lo Yasu Mimena. The only kli in the Beit HaMikdash inside, which had the sticks all the time connected to it, not only when while traveling, also during the camp, while they rested, were the Badim. And the reason is very simple. The Torah has always to be ready to be in motion. Whenever you see it, even it stands, it has to be ready to go. Interesting, Rav Hirsch explained that it has to be ready to go to the Galut. The Nazir explained it has always to be ready to go back to Eretz Yisrael. So I leave that open. I don't want politics. But I would like certainly to share that with you and to say the way that Rabbi Jay and his wife and Laser and Shaina Freeman do that is most remarkable, and I think that's a really they deserve a big, big Yisher Koach for everything they did. That it's a wonderful conference. The booklet Laser is a really outstanding achievement. Thank you very much. So I would like to present you today a topic the way I think I would like to the way I like to teach it. There is some learning with it. There is a good learning. And I think it is a topic which is very educational. I had the privilege to teach for 7 years children in Alon Shavuot during the Shiur for the adults in the Beit Midrash, and I learned a lot from these cute little children. And I asked them, when I was preparing a big presentation on Lot Amod Adam Recha, I asked the children, grade 5 to 8, Ma ta choshev al Lot Amod Adam Recha? Tell me a story. It was most wonderful to see little children telling stories about Lot Amod Adam Recha. I read the Rambam that it's not only if somebody really bleeds and is about to die, even if somebody is in any danger and needs help, tell me a story. And they came up, some 30, 40 children, with fascinating stories, and I could see that giving the pasuk and all the explanation is really an excellent educational tool for children and for everybody, of course, to talk about that. I shouldn't call my lecture The Good Samaritan Law, I prefer to call it Lot Amod Al Dam Recha. So that was for marketing purposes only, but I wanted to talk about the Pasuk. I would like to explain, I apologize, I have it only in Hebrew. It's online, there's a lecture which you can listen to the text. And I would like to learn the Parshanut of the text, the learning of Pshat, and I will spend quite a lot of time on that aspect. I would like to explain the Gemara, and I think there are very interesting insights if we look at that in a very broad picture. Of course, we need a good understanding of the Gemara, but there is a lot of interesting messages coming out. The Poskei Halacha will be very short. It's interesting if we compare this Halacha of Lo Tamod Al Dam Recha to the Christian tradition of the Good Samaritan Law. And it brings us very interesting insights about the Jewish tradition, the Christian tradition, Mamash Lahavdil, Elef Alfei Avdalot, and there are very interesting insights on a broader comparison. If we compare it to the law in the States, in Europe, or the lacking law in the States of Europe, we have better lawyers in the audience, but I would like to make my comments and will be happy to hear your insights. And we compare that to the Halacha, to the Rishonim, and to the law in Israel, there is really Chaye Olam Nata B'tocheinu to compare that, and I trust there is a lot to learn for physicians and for everybody to be involved in chesed, to help others, because it's a part of Lo Tamod Al Dam Recha. So it's really an overriding topic. All the topics which I prepare, I try to follow a certain flow, a structure. general background, green. For instance, here the Genovese case, which I will present shortly, the Good Samaritan law, bystander effect, many interesting issues of which are not directly related, just as an introduction. Interesting enough, my father, Admir Veslim, is a survivor of the Holocaust. And of course, we had a lot of discussions about his experiences, the tragedies in Auschwitz. He was for 3.5 years in camps, and it is a miracle our person survived, like everybody who survived. And I very often ask him questions. I asked him once, what was the hardest experience for you? And there's a list. In 3.5 years in hell, there's quite a list. And he was very short to give me a clear answer. To see after the war people, when we were liberated, and to see the Germans standing next door, across the fence, and telling them, we haven't von nichts gewusst, we didn't know anything. But they saw the smoke and they saw the killing. And they say that they saw them every morning passing there, and still they say, we didn't know anything. That was the deepest disappointment and pain to see that. So if that is the negative experience, we should really be outstanding to be Lotam Olam Recha in a positive sense. There is a lot to say in general background. I would like to learn the Pasuk. I have some Chidushim, I think, or a new, at least for me, new insights in the Gemara, Rishonim, and to flow a very chronological sequence here, Rishonim, including the Israeli law, Mishpat, and some case studies. Here it starts really to be interesting. What should we do? How should we organize our tzedakah, whether it is financial, our time we have for social involvement? These are very general questions. I think that medicine, per se, according to some Mefarshim, is lotamod adam recha. You learn how to respond if somebody is in need. Not only a hematologist, as I trained, dam recha. It's, of course, for everybody. Emergency medicine, hatzola system. So it is much more than one specific issue. It is a very, very broad aspect. And there are interesting questions. I try to put interesting questions to discuss at the end. Of course, don't worry, I will keep my time to present it briefly. I think that this flow, which I just show you with the animation, we should learn to compare these issues. The Pasuk, what can we learn in the Pasuk according to the Gemara and Rishonim? How do the Gemara and Rishonim explain the Pasuk? This tradition is something very unique about our tradition. There is no tradition in the world where everything is connected over 2,000, 3,000 years. So I would like to start, and a very interesting aspect, particularly here, comes into the question, what is said, what does the law, the halakha, dictate? What is included in the halakha? It's true, elulav has very clear definitions, shlosha tfachim, arba tfachim, it's very clearly defined, shulchan aruch. Lo tamod adam ra'echa, we have to respond in a way which prevents danger. Is the behavior only clearly halachically predicted, dictated, or is there a way that everybody has to decide and to make his own effort the way he sees it, with the place he lives? Interesting that the Gemara says that Lo tamod adam recha has a special din. Everybody has to make an effort and has to make all possible steps in order to accomplish that. So there is something built in which asks everybody individually, do whatever you can. So the personal assessment in each situation for himself is dictated, but at the end we have to decide our own. It's a very interesting question of Musar, and the lawyer will ask the question. My neighbor, Noam Solberg, is recently a Shofet Beit Mishpat HaElyon. I keep asking him, since the law is introduced in Israel, do you know about the case where a person was in jail for up to 1 year by not helping? He doesn't know a case, but the law clearly defines that. Hanan Porat, that we will see in a moment. So these questions are halachically interesting, and socially is in Israel, of course. It started the awareness, as Mr. Kurtzman told me before, the awareness in the States. I know that from the writings, that there was a case called the Kitty Genovese case, a young lady who was killed, stabbed to death in her front home. There were 38 who saw her, and they didn't call the police. And there was a lot of awareness. I don't know if all the stories and all the cartoons are true, and there is an interesting paper, the story is more terrible, in fact, what really happened, but I think from the message, it is a very powerful and caused a lot of attention that a person was killed. A lot of people heard it, saw it, were aware, but nobody saw it, nobody heard it, and nobody was involved. It happened to me personally once when I was in Air Canada in my training in Toronto, and at the beginning of the flight, after half an hour, the stewardess asked, is there a doctor on board? And I'm very happy to help. And I run, yes, and I saw a person in a heart attack, a very clear picture, and I wanted to open, please, the first aid box. Oh, we have first to see the license. So I had no license in Canada, and the Israeli, they didn't accept. So I asked him, just call if there is somebody who has certain drugs available. Five people came, and I was Baruch Hashem successful to do it online. We turned back, and afterwards I asked, tell me, are there other doctors on board? Five others were on board. Nobody wanted to touch. I did a resuscitation for 20 minutes, and the Siyata Deshmaya, it was successful. Five doctors were on board. There were nurses who helped me, who were very helpful. And I was asking, why didn't they help? Because the law says, if you make a mistake, you're in bad shape. The good Samaritan law tells you only one thing. You did a mistake. Even though you had a good intention, you are not an emergency doctor expert, you made it, you had a good intention, nobody else was around, you are protected, even though you did a mistake. It is not the din lechatchila you should help. If five doctors are there and none of them wants to help and he dies, nobody will be sued. Only if you help and make a mistake, you can protect yourself by the good Samaritan law. The halakha is totally different, and the Israeli law as well. So there's a lot to discuss about that. I want to start, and I have no intention to present here the New Testament, but I think we can learn a lot since it is the background of the law. And since there are very interesting hints, I have it on the later slide in the presentation. This Good Samaritan law in the New Testament talks, you can read the text that there people came by, there was a priest who happened to be there, and there was a Levi who was there, but nobody helped. But there was one good Samaritan, as he traveled, and he came and he helped, and he took him and he saved him. That's the story. From this story, Maisa Shahoyo Kivyachol, we learn there is a value, but it is not an obligation. It is just a nice story about somebody who helped. In parentheses, I want to say, why is it important whether he was a priest or a Levi? And he was a Stam Yisrael, what is that? And interesting research, I showed it from Shtarak Bilobek and another Jakob Mann from the early 20th century. That is a polemic against the Judaism. Because on the way between Jericho and Jerusalem, the Mishnah says that 24 Mishmarot of Kohanim lived in Jerusalem. The families lived in Jerusalem. So the way from Jerusalem to Jericho was a way where a lot of Kohanim were traveling for the Mishmarot and the Beit HaMikdash. The message of this story is that look at that, these dirty Jews, they go to the Beit HaMikdash and they do the work there, but they don't help. And this Samaritan, which status is very questionable, whether Kuti, Shomroni, what status, halachic status he is, he helped. So the message here is, you can be helpful, but you don't need to be a rabbi, you don't need to be a holy Jew who goes to the Beit HaMikdash to do the job. There's quite a lot of attack aggressiveness between the Jewish tradition, the Kohanim, and the message of Christianity. That is the law arising from here, is certainly not strong enough to make a mitzvah and a strong halachic or a strong legal basis. That's just the background. As I mentioned before, there is no general duty to come to rescue, only in two situations. When a person created it, he caused an accident, you have to help, or a special relationship, as summarized here. In Israel, if I happen to be close to Hanan Porat to understand the Chavir Knesset, he introduced the law and there's interesting writing about it. Certainly in Israel, teaching ethics, Jewish ethics, it's a very good entry to ask, oh, don't talk about the Jewish religion, talk about the Israeli law. And since it is a law, Baruch Hashem, many people will be interested to understand the Israeli law and go back to the sources in the Bible, in the Gemara, in the Mishnah, to go back to the Poskim and understand his background. Interesting enough, as Hanan Porat said and wrote, he was motivated for this chok, to introduce this law, because he learned in the yeshiva, and he presents clearly when he was learning with Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, son of Rav Kook, Zichrono Livracha, Zichrono Livracha, he learned how important the involvement and the engagement for other people is, and he wanted to introduce that from the Beit Midrash to the Knesset when he was a member. So that is a very interesting topic to analyze and to understand the historical background of the law, his proposals, the rejections, the modifications, and to learn how it came in. As I told you, I would like to compare the features of the traditional halachical biblical law, the Israeli and the Christian and secular law of the Good Samaritan. That is one of the purposes to elaborate here. Let's start with Parshanut HaTanach. Lo telech achil be'amecha, lo ta'amot al dam re'echa ani Hashem. You should not go and be a tail bearer. You should not go from one to the other and talk about lashon hara or things that shouldn't be public. Lo ta'amod al dam re'echa ani Hashem. There is a lot to say just parshanut ha-pasuk. What is the meaning of lo ta'amot? You shouldn't stand. So it means you should sit down or you should run away. Al dam re'echa, only if he is bleeding. If he is not really bleeding, does it apply as well? Who is the re'echa? Jewish person, non-Jewish person, neighbors, a close neighbor, more distant neighbors. Why do we need at the end ani Hashem? What's the connection to the first part of the pasuk and to the second one? And here is a wonderful, wonderful world of parshanot, a rich world, and I think really fascinating world. I don't think somebody has to wait for Parshat Kedushim to talk about that, but certainly shouldn't miss Parshat Kedushim to talk one of these mitzvot. There are many interesting applications in other parshiot as well, and it really reflects much more than just the text there. So I would like to give you some insights from these questions here. For instance, at the very beginning of the Bible, of the Torah, Cain and Hevel, after Cain killed Hevel, Hashem asked him the question, where is your brother? Does Hashem not know where he is? Does Hashem need information from Hevel to tell him that the brother isn't around, that he is dead? Certainly not. So the answer is very clear. Hashomer achi anochi? It's not my business. I don't care. That is the classical statement. I don't mind la'amod al dam re'echa. Very interesting that Leo Alexander, in his famous paper, New England Journal of Medicine, in 1949, when he described the laws in the court in Germany, the Nuremberg doctor trials, he has a very long paper named Medicine Under Dictatorship, and he described what happened in the Holocaust. And he ends at the end, indeed, only if we have more awareness and respect and responsibility, we can give the proper answer to the divine question, where is your brother's blood? So this pasuk has a strong message. Not halacha lemase, Kain and Hevel, we don't belong to halacha, but it really reflects, kol demei achicha tzoakim alai min ha'adama, but don't stand. And he denied it. He was the first bystander. Avraham was praying. There are many other sources which I cannot go in detail, but are very interesting to learn. Mordechai told his niece, Esther, if the Jewish people is in danger, you better go and help, despite that there is a certain risk. So that's not a halachic question, but it's a very interesting story in the Bible. That is a slide which I would be happy to discuss at least in an hour and a half to understand the smichut parshiot of this mitzvah. And I will make it very short. Lo ta'amod al dam re'echa appears here. And a lot was written, PhD theses, to explain the sequence of the mitzvot and averot in Parshat Kedushim. The last one is Ve'ahavta l'recha kamocha. It's a positive commandment. You should love your fellow man. In between, and I divided it, things which are done b'fahesia, the first five. The next five, you should not abuse people who are weak, abuse them, b'tzina, b'shom yachid.
And here there is some social aspects of social justice, lokas to other bhagavata, and you're responsible for each other. You should is part of it. It's, and afterwards anishet. So I feel that lokamoda damlecha is actually the system of justice in the society. You should help each other. Not standing idle would motivate you to take care for justice in a much broader social justice on different levels. As I said, there is a lot to learn about that, but I will skip that. There is a refinement along the whole text, and I think it works very, very beautifully. Here is Lo Tamod Al Dam Le'echa. Rashi says, you should not stand there. Sorry, I would point out Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra has an explanation. If you haruchel matik yikne mize v'mize, if you go from one to the other, you take information, and at the end you might kill them. There is another isul. If you stand there and you do not help, it's like the opposite. So there is lo telech achil ba'amecha. They are connected, but they're actually the opposite. Ani Hashem. Interesting insights were given by the Rambam halacha lemase. Here we see the Rambam keparshan haTanach, parshan haTorah, and he says in his Hilchot Deot, Lechach nismach lo ta'amod al dam recha. Why? Because a person who takes bad information and talks about the other, he brings the example from Doeg haEdomi. If he transgresses the isur shelo telech ba'amecha. ואף על פי שאין לוקים על דבר זה, אבון גדול הוא, וגורם להרוג נפשות רבות מישראל. If somebody talks לשון הרע, and more than that, לא תלך רחיל בעמך, can cause that you create a situation where your neighbor, your fellow man, will be bleeding. At that stage, you shouldn't stand there. So not only are you not allowed to do that, but if you caused it, or somebody else caused it, לא תעמוד על דם רעך, you should prevent the next stage. It's like a refinement. If from A, B, it happened, you should go and protect also the second isu. I will skip these psukim. The Chizkuni, one of the interesting parshanim, connected these Isurim together. Lo telech kedei shelo ta'amod al dam re'echa. One should prevent the other. And at the end he says, in Yecheskel, he brings the pasuk from Sefer Yecheskel, and he shows that the Bible explains himself. Anshei Rachel hayubach lema'an shfoch dam. The behavior in society, talking about each other, killed each other. So he brings a pasuk to show that the pasuk in Parshat Vayikra, in Sefer Vayikra, are connected. In another way, the Yerushalmi says, sometimes you are allowed, you have the obligation to say something which is not Rachil Ba'amecha, but it is like Ke'ilu Rachil Ba'amecha. What is the situation? If I know about two parties, they are fighting, and I know one is right, and the other one isn't, and I could come out and talk, I should come and talk, because if I don't do so, by not telling the truth, by not getting involved, what a wonderful message. I mean, I mentioned before Holocaust stories, and I should mention the other story from my maternal side. The family was saved by people, Christian people, who saved her for many months in their basement. There are people who took the risk, and they lo ta'amod al dam re'echa, knowing that there is a severe risk, and they helped. That is what the Yerushalmi says. Sometimes you have to get engaged. Velo ta'amod al dam re'echa, that causes you to go to the first part of the pasuk. Lo telech rachil ba'amecha, to talk irrelevant or wrong things you shouldn't. But if you can make a right statement, you should go and save him, even though it sounds like talking about other people. So that is the Rashi and Bala Turim. A fascinating comment on that was given by the Ochai Makadosh in Sefer Breshit. We know when Yaakov took away the Bchora from Esav, motivated by his mother, Rivka, Rivka told afterwards to Yitzchak, she told Yitzchak, I'm not happy that our son Yaakov will take a girl from here. She should go back to my homeland, hometown, to my family at home. And she told Yaakov, listen, I know Esav is going to kill you. Get out of here. If he is in danger of life, why shouldn't she tell both Yaakov and Yitzchak the same information? If that's not true, she should tell them, listen, go for a shidduch, go at home. You cannot have a split information. Says Olam HaKadosh, that is the explanation of Lo Telech Achil Ve'Amecha. If there is no need to say to somebody, you should not talk what is not necessary. Therefore, to tell Yaakov, she can then tell Yitzchak, she can tell him, I want the shidduch, I eat the shemaim. She'd go back to have a nice girl. There is no need to explain him the urgency and the danger that if you stay here another day, you might be dead. But to Yaakov, she explained, since he knew exactly what the feelings of Esav are towards him, you better run away today. Because if I send you back from home, there has to be a really strong reason for you. So this split information, he wants to see that based on the Yerushalmi in this pasuk here.
So we learned quite a lot of interesting things, and there would be, as I mentioned, much more to elaborate on that. There is a lot telech, you shouldn't walk and say, and you should not stand, you have to find the right balance. We come now to the world of the Mishnah and of the Gemara, which is a little bit another world, and that is a halachical translation of some of these values. And a very interesting Gemara talking about the Rodef discusses in Masechet Sanhedrin the issue of lotelech, lotamod al damrecha. And the question there is asked, a very interesting sugya, why do we know, what is the difference between the obligation of hashef teshivim, return him whatever he needs, and what is the difference between lotamod al damrecha? Hashef teshivim, if somebody lost his object here, it's a lost and found, I should return it to him, it's my obligation to give it back to him. Lota moda dam re'echa is I should help him. And the Gemara has this explanation. And the Gemara says here, minayin l'rodef achar chavero shnitan lahatzilo benafsho. How do we know that I'm allowed to save somebody who is in danger from somebody else? And I should save A, who is in danger, from B, and I'm even allowed to kill B if he's going to endanger A. Talmud lamar lota moda dam re'echa. Therefore, in order to save him from wrong behavior from B, he is trying to kill him, I'm allowed to kill B, b'sh'at maser. V'ad ha'achim da'ata, ha'im ba'il elechem tanya, minay lo et chavero shehu tovea banar. Where do we know if I see my friend in the water and he can't swim? O chaya gora oto, a beast, or listin, Professor Steinberg mentioned it in Gemara. Shehu chayav la'atzilo, how do I know that I have to save him? Tamut amar lo tamot adam ha'echa. So we learn that from the pasuk Lo tamod adam recha, I have to save him. Afterwards, the Gemara asks, might be we can learn that from another pasuk. We could learn that from Avedas Uforminayim Talmud Amar Hashem Otaro. No, the Gemara says there's a difference. Im hatam hava amina hanamil benafshi. Aval, here the important color is not here. I lost the color. Now it is here. Aval mitrach umega regura eimalo. Might be to go actively, to make an effort, mitrach, tircha, umegar agura, and to hire somebody, that would not be included in the mitzvah of v'hashevotalo. If I can bring it back to him, fine. But I don't have to find a system to bring it back. It's just I have to bring it, it's my obligation towards him. Lo tamod adam recha, the Gemara wants to explain, it includes the mitzvah to make all effort to bring it back to him. And I think here we come to a fascinating Gemara. My behavior is not only the object that is lost and to bring it back to the owner, that is Hashif Tishivim. It is, I have to make sure that the obligation that applies to me has to be
activated by everybody. Mitzvah, I have to make an additional effort. If I compare this principle, halachical principle, to Kant, the categorical imperative, I have to behave in the way that everybody who behaves this way, the society will be better, which is a very nice input from Kant. That's exactly what the Gemara says. It's not only I have to do it towards him, I have to make sure that everybody who wants to do that, anybody who is in danger, I have to make sure that the system works like that. That's like a source of, I don't need a source for Kant, and Kant doesn't know, he does not need a source from me, from the Gemara, but I think that's the idea. We have to behave in a way. The Rishonim explained that we have to make sure, we'll see Rabbeinu Yonah in a moment, that we have to make sure that in every city should be people who help. So our emergency shift 24 hours, or a Hatzalah organization, or security, or anything else that prevents danger, has to be established in order to lekayem lo tamod al dam re'echa. Not only if it happens to me, here is a lost object, I have to return it. It is on a priori system, organizational level, that it has to be provided for the health system. I think that is a good, fascinating example for this concept. I want now to discuss the Rambam, how he explains the Gemara, and that is in this slide. The Rambam has several sources, and he faces here halachical and moral values on this Gemara. And there are interesting differences which I tried to point out in blue in the text here. Gemara is in black. I don't think in your handouts you will see it, but here it comes out hopefully better. Kol hayachol hatzil velo hatzil over alo tamod al dam recha. Everybody who can save and doesn't do so, he transgresses lo tamod al dam recha. So the Rambam is very accurate. He doesn't say, like the Gemara says, minayin l'roed chavro sheyachol hatzil. The Rambam adds, kol hayachol. First of all, make sure you can swim. Because if you can't swim, and we have the problem, one who is in the water, if you jump in the water, we'll have a double problem and no solution. So he clearly explains what are your capability. As you explained before, there is a risk. Pashut, even if he's the Olympic swimmer, there is still a danger to save him. Here he has to apply his common sense or his capability, what he is capable to do. And the mitzvah after says, v'yachol l'hatzilo. And he is capable to do so, if not. And he brings here more examples, which are not all included in the Gemara, because he gives really a full power to this halakha. And here he says a very interesting legal or philosophical addition from him. Afal pi she'en lo kim alav, alavim elu lipnei she'en bahem maaseh. If he stands idle and doesn't do anything, I cannot blame him. Five people in the airplane, nobody can be blamed. They didn't hear, they slept, there were whatever they have, they don't need the tilts. Rambam says, I know exactly. You can stand like that and you can have your 15 tilts why you didn't get involved. But he says, Afar pi she'en lokim alav she'en bo maaseh. I cannot force him. Chamurim hem, even though shekol ha-ma'avet nefesh achat, and the right manuscripts don't read Mishrael, everybody who causes the situation that the person is lost, one soul is lost, not necessarily Mishrael, kilu ibed olam male, Mishnah in Sanhedrin. He takes another Mishnah from Sanhedrin to point out the importance. V'chol ha-makayem nefesh achat, kilu kiyem olam male. So he gives a lot of importance to this mitzvah, knowing that we can't force to do that, but there is a moral obligation, which is halachically. If somebody didn't do it, no Beit Din can blame him, you have to go to court. That's interesting. What does the Israeli law say? The Israeli law says in the text, the knas at shana, up to 1 year in jail. I never heard about any situation like that, but here I think we come in a very interesting field to reflect on the difference between the law and the halacha. If I have a teacher which I highly respect, and I know he wants something, or a family, so somebody who I highly respect, if I know he wants something, I go and do it. He doesn't have to order, he doesn't have to threaten me, I just do it. The halachical system has here obviously a possibility. We really want you to help. Can we force you to endanger yourself? No. You feel it's a danger, we cannot force you. But you should really do it. It's more than highly recommended. Legally, we cannot force you to do that. The legal system in Israel, tries to enhance that you have to do it. It doesn't happen. One case happened. The non-Jewish system says, if you do a mistake and you did it, the good Samaritan law just saved you. You're not in jail because you made a mistake. But a priori, nobody would really be capable to force you to do that. I think this interaction, as elaborated beautifully by Aaron Kirschenbaum in his many wonderful papers on that topic, explained that nicely. And we have a lot of other examples. Who pays for it? You mentioned before, who pays for it? And these are very interesting halachot in the Rosh Yad Rama, which I cannot elaborate here, but the question of the payment actually reflects that if somebody can't pay for it, the society has the obligation to pay for it. Because the mitzvah is a social obligation. I just happened to be next to the water and I had to jump. But if I lost my watch and my iPhone and whatever, my wallet in the water, somebody pays for that. Who? If I can't afford it, and the person who was saved can't afford it, if he wasn't saved, he certainly can't afford it. But the society has to take care. So these halachot reflect that there is a social obligation. It's an interesting game now to understand. Here's the text. V'tov v'nachon me'ot liot b'chol ir v'ir mitnavim ba'am min ha'maskilim. It's good that in every city should be people who are mitnadvim, volunteers, min ha'maskilim. These are the really smart people. You can't pay somebody who volunteers. There's not enough money to pay somebody who volunteers, who does it for free. So the mitzvah says you have to do it as a volunteer act, because the mitzvah wants you to do more than the mitzvah could dictate. That's a very, very interesting source to support that. At the end, I would like to do a triangle, which is a great exercise. We ask at the beginning the question, the Jewish law, the Christian source and secular law, and the Israeli law. So I'm really interested in that, but the comparison, and that's a very transcultural comparison of this concept to help the to help others, it would be interesting to prepare a triangle, halacha, secular law, and the Israeli law. And the halacha is really outstanding in that field, that there is an obligation to do it. The secular law has no obligation, just a protection. And the Israeli law wants to include more, which is not capable, which is not done in other legal systems. We have it in Israel, and we should be very proud. Al-chok lo tamod al-dam re'echa. So to compare that, I summarize it here. We don't have the time to elaborate it. Rav Halpern wrote about that. As I summarized, it's an educational story, really a nice one, but no legal implication coming out from that. What I wanted to present here is a systematic review. What is the problem? The relevance, biblical Mishnah, the Talmudic sources, Rishonim, Achonim, how it comes here. I added at the end that that's actually for me now the most interesting part. I'm happy to learn more about the sources, how to present them better. I will be happy to hear your comments. But what I would like to see at the end, in the questions, what's the personal meaning for everybody for this mitzvah? After he learned it, and he has to learn it carefully, what is his take-home message from that? And I think it's very interesting to discuss the relationship about mitzvah, religious, moral obligation, and legal, civilian obligation on that, which is a very interesting interface of these issues. There are many interesting questions that I mentioned at the beginning. For instance, the boat people. Many other stories we have in Israel, we are facing interesting challenges. People from Egypt escaping through the borders to Israel, and nobody else saves them in the Arab world. But we open the borders for them, and they stay in Israel. How long do we have to save them if they're in a life-threatening condition? So there are much broader issues just than a one-to-one person. There are political issues related to that. Hilchot Tzedakah are very much related, and I think it's a Chodesh Tshuva. Elul ani ledodi vedodi li mamash lo tamod al dam recha. There are many, many ways we could help each other, and we should see that as a special mitzvah, a moral obligation, and a special privilege. To ask all these questions, I leave that with you. Any easy questions, I would be happy to hear. I think it was in the 60s. I know it from Wikipedia. That's my personal experience with the boat people, but I read about that, and a lot of people died. But I can tell you from Switzerland, where I grew up, as you heard, my parents survived the Holocaust, and I ask very often, where has the Jewish community been during the war? I prefer not to answer. I know that there were Swiss people, we just visited recently Hungary, Budapest, and there was a non-Jewish guy from Switzerland, Zichrono Livracha, Lutz, and he saved 63,000 people by falsifying papers. He was really an example of Lo Tamod al Dam Recha, and Raoul Wallenberg and many others. So we have a lot to learn, and I really feel we have to refine our ethical and social involvement in order to be Raoui Lo Tamod al Dam Recha.
Okay. Last but not least, Rabbi Dr. Eddie, it's a book club, right? All right. And apparently I have been told you don't have to read the book and there are no slides, right?
No slides.
You didn't have to read the book.
Okay.
You got it. Finish
it.
Take it away.
First of all, like all the other speakers and all the other participants, she has an outstanding Yeshivah to our organizers, to Rabbi Jay, to Dr. Laser, and all the others involved for what has been an extraordinary experience. Every single presentation was truly outstanding, extraordinary. The amazing thing is you'll probably have a few months worth of work just to go through slides and the presentations and the infrastructure and all these other things. As you can see, I do not have a PowerPoint presentation, so I guess you could say my presentation is pointless. Now, of course, after a presentation like Betty, there's no way I can do a PowerPoint presentation. But what I'd like to do, actually, is a different format than we've done throughout the conference, just in the last few minutes of our conference. And that is, in lieu of an exam, rather than give you an exam, which would probably make a number of you shit, what we're going to do is we're going to do a practical application of all that we have learned over the conference. And we're going to use, as our vehicle, we're going to use a book. And the book is called My Sister's Keeper. How many people here have read the book My Sister's Keeper? How many people here have seen the movie My Sister's Keeper? This one is for the men's audience. How many people here have seen the book? Excellent. Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to read through the plot summary. For this, I ask you to turn to the syllabus, page 156. We're going to read through the plot summary, and I'm going to ask you to take all the principles that you've learned throughout this conference and to identify what the halachic issues are. Rabbi Dr. Steinberg said one of the major debates, one of the major issues, is to simply identify what the halachic issues are, identify what the ethical issues are. So let us put our knowledge to the test. I will read through the plot summary, and your objective is to identify what the halachic issues are. We will very briefly just address them in our closing session. I read from the top of page 156. Our plot summary. Anna Fitzgerald's older sister, Kate, suffers from leukemia. It's a fictional story, by the way. Anna Fitzgerald's older sister, Kate, suffers from leukemia, a cancer of the blood and bone marrow. Anna was conceived
required for both patient and would be major. It is not guaranteed to work, as the stress of the operation may well kill Kate anyway. And the loss of the kidney could have a serious impact on Anna's life. Anna petitions for medical emancipation with the help of a lawyer, Alexander, so that she will be able to make her own decision and not be forced by her parents about whether she wants to donate a kidney to her sister or not. During the trial, it is revealed that Kate had asked her sister Anna to sue for emancipation because she did not want Anna to have to donate her kidney. She does not want a kidney donation and believes that she will die anyway. The judge rules in Anna's favor and grants Campbell medical power of attorney. However, and this only happens in the movies and the books, as Campbell drives her home after the trial, they get into a car accident. Anna is unconscious and suffers an injury to the head. After some time, the doctor informs them that Anna is brain dead, that the machine keeping her alive may as well be shut off, and asks them if they have considered organ donation. Campbell steps in and declares that he has the power of attorney and, quote, "There is a girl upstairs who needs that kidney. Kate is prepped for surgery and the kidney is successfully transplanted. Kate survives the surgery and goes into remission. Most of Anna's other usable organs are removed for transplants in the future." Okay, now let's begin our exam. Let's identify what the halakhic issues are from this story. Is there PGD for Anna? Yes, there is PGD for Anna. So that's issue number one. Issue number one is creating a child for the sole purpose of being a donor to an existing sibling. Issue number one. Any other issues? If there's no other issues, then we failed.
The risk of surgery.
Risk of surgery for Anna for her kidney donation.
Before that, does she have consent? She was consent.
Excellent. Consent issues. So the issue of consent for pediatric consent came up a number of times during the course of our conference. We mentioned with respect to Milo, we mentioned actually this was the reason the German courts said that circumcision shouldn't be performed because a child of that age is not able to provide consent. So here you have a child at ages up to 13 from birth to age 18. First of all, she didn't consent to birth either, consent to the production of the PGD, who was subjected to different forms of donation. And we'll discuss the different forms of donation briefly, bone marrow donation, blood donation, and ultimately even kidney donation. Is it permitted for her to agree to those procedures? Can we coerce her to undergo those? Any other points before we finish?
Her sister doesn't, her sister's concerned about receiving the kidney or not.
Is
her sister
Excellent. So is her sister, the sister Kate, is she permitted to refuse the kidney? She's also a child. And she's undergoing treatment for her disease. And she says, I don't want to undergo this treatment for disease. Is she permitted to refuse care? Or is it usher for her to refuse care? What's the halakhic status about compelling coercing? Anything else before we continue?
And brain dead.
Excellent. I can just brain dead. I can't leave this conference without losing brain dead. So we have the end, which we're not going to discuss, but we've beat it to death, I think, the issue of brain dead. But I do encourage you to look at some of the cartoons in the back. It was actually quite amusing. But absolutely true. The brain dead issue is a major issue. Is the matter considered how lucky that is it permissible to harvest the kidney? Is it not permitted to harvest her kidney? Should we wait, as our Dr. Shabtai talked about, till she sustains cardiac death and maybe we harvest her kidney in advance? Let's turn our attention to very quickly to some of the earlier issues we mentioned. Number one, on page 156 of our handout, and that is pre-implantation genetic diagnosis for the purpose of creating a child who will be will serve as treatment to an existing child. The term that has been coined in the secular world is called savior sibling. To create is called a savior sibling. Now, if you turn the clock back to 1990, and you see the original Time article here in your handout, there was a couple called the Ayala family who had a child who suffered from Fanconi's anemia. And they searched the world over to be able to find a donor. The only treatment was bone marrow donation, and they were unsuccessful. So what did they do? They conceived a child in a natural way in the hopes that a new child would be a match to the existing child. There's a 1 in 4 chance that would take place. They would be mutually matched. So that's how they did, and as Hashbacha would have it, that child turned out to be that 1 in 4. The child was an exact match. And they performed a bone marrow harvest from that child with a successful cure of their existing child. And in this past year, it's been 20 years, they actually reinterviewed the entire family. Everybody's alive, and a very interesting poster. Fast forward now to the 21st century, they've been advancing on two fronts with respect to this kind of scenario. Front number one is that the post-Yale family, who had to take a chance 1 in 4 that they could create a child that was an exact match. In today's technology, as we now know from our conference, you don't have to take a chance anymore. You can provide the reproductive seed of the husband and the wife, and you can give it to the laboratory, they can fertilize it, and they can choose exactly which embryo is a match, an HLA match, to an existing child. And in fact, there have been probably a little more than a handful of cases, there's more cases in the last 2 years, of exactly the scenario happening. The last one I'm familiar with, and there are a number of others that took place in England. Same scenario, family had a child that suffered with Fanconi's anemia. They went to the fertility specialist, they collected the exact embryo, which is an HLA match. They implanted that embryo into the woman, carried the child 9 months. But here's the other additional factor, which is new technology since the time of the Ayala. They don't even have to wait for the child to be born to perform a bone marrow harvest on the child. In the delivery room, from the umbilical cord, they harvest stem cells from the umbilical cord. Those stem cells are blood stem cells, and they were used to regenerate the entire bone marrow that the child suffered from Fanconi's anemia, completely cured the child. That's the situation now in the 21st century. It's not science fiction. These things are happening in other countries. So from a halachic perspective, we know now from our conference, we have learned, it is permitted to do PGD for sure to prevent the development of a child with the Payback disease or other severe diseases. Is it permitted to produce an embryo when there is no disease for the parents, but you are creating the embryo to save an existing child? So that's a fascinating question, and the short answer is, while the secular world is averse to this, secular world is very concerned, how can you create a child with the sole purpose of saving another child? From a halachic perspective, creating a child is always a fulfillment of the myth of Puruvu. Here you have the additional aspect, with the creation of the child, you have another mitzvah, a few mitzvah, a false question for somebody else. So you have got a tremendous advantage here, and I know there are probably a handful of cases of savior siblings that have come across to the So you proved that you have two cases of savior sibling in Shari's account. So let's turn, and we can actually see, which on the upper right-hand side of page 157, the very process of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, and those series of slides show the extraction of one cell from the 8-cell embryo in the process of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. By the way, just something to realize also, the embryo not only has to be an HLA match, the embryo also has to not have the disease that is genetically carried by the parent. So if it's Fanconi's anemia, you want to make sure the new child doesn't have Fanconi's anemia in addition to being an HLA match, meaning to the child that they want to transfer. So it's not such a simple procedure, not so easily done. Our next issue, reading the bottom of 157. Anna, the only compatible family member, has been used as a donor for any other bodily substance needed to treat pain and continues to swing between remission and relapse as she grows up. So what substances were harvested from Kate, what substances were harvested from Anna when she was a young child? Blood and bone marrow. So what's the halacha? How do we feel? How does the secular world feel? What's the halacha about harvesting blood and bone marrow from a child who clearly, under no circumstances, can get them? Are we comfortable with that? Are we not comfortable with that? And we said consent in the secular world is an issue, but even in the secular world today, do they
from a child. Let's say you have the following scenario. Look on page 158. From the pediatric journal, designing an ethical policy for bone marrow donation by a minor. The child was 2 years, 8 months old, weighed 25 pounds, one-fifth away from mother, for whom she was to be the bone marrow donor. The mother had suffered a relapse of leukemia. Her physicians recommended a bone marrow transplant. The child was the closest HLA match and the best donor for her mother's transplant. Are we, as an ethics committee, going to allow the harvesting of a two-year-old, eight-month child bone marrow in order to save the life of the mother? What do we vote on that? So what is defined as child's best interest? So generally, if you determine best interests for that child in a vacuum, does this child in a medical fashion benefit from the harvesting of the bone marrow? In his child's sick?
Psychologically.
Okay, I got that. So the answer is, from a medical definition, this child has zero benefit from harvesting bone marrow from them. Not only zero benefit, has potential harm. There are risks of infection, I mean, probably not death, but there are risks of infection to the child. But if you take the broader picture and you think of greater best interests, it is clearly 100% within the best interest of this child to have a mother who is alive as opposed to one mother who is not alive. But it becomes very complicated in the secular world. There's an interesting distinction between consent and assent. Now, a child who is 2 years old, obviously you can't understand the procedure whatsoever. But a child who is 6, 7, or maybe 8, 9, 10 years old may be old enough to understand the procedure, but not at a legal age where they can consent to the procedure. Consent is a legal term. Assent means they understand the procedure. So I introduced this distinction because it's relevant to the next point. So what do the postings say? So if you look at the, and again, we'll just give you one source here, on page 158, Contention Initials Agram. Pashtalas the Ma'efim, regarding transplant of bone marrow. Hatorim sovel mikavim chazakim. The donor suffers greatly. Ad de pashtas reaching my chingo maradona kalim. Where sometimes you have to give general anesthesia. Now today you may not have to give general anesthesia in many of the cases. But you write, the Ori Yadon shows on Orbach Data. Shemutu Lotaka Yellow Kitorain, you can indeed take a child as a donor, even who bar Daf Umatim Lazar, if he is at the age of assent. Okay, he's not an adult, but it's the age of assent. Today, Latil is Benchrat on the Sense of Christ, in order to treat a family member who is ill. However, he who has died loni dialios barda, if he is or she is 2 years and 8 months old, not dial barda, who has torn by this dihaes shari, and you are this child is the only possible donor, sorry, you and the adult will have a relationship with Sima Borofila to the Shikata. Then you have to convene a committee of post-team and physicians and give very serious thought to the allowed donation. Now what about the case of kidney donation? Let us skip to page 150. We talked about the difference between assent and consent, and in fact, in the secular world, there are ethicists, there are hospitals that would indeed allow a child under the age of assent to serve as a donor in such a scenario. But what about a kidney donation? Anna is usually willing to donate whatever she needs, but when she's 13 years old, they want her to donate a kidney. And she says, oh, slow down. Kidney, everything else I'm willing to give, kidney I'm not so sure I'm willing to give. Is there a difference between donating the bone marrow and the blood versus donating the kidney, and what's the difference?
Risk.
I'm sorry?
Risk and suffering.
Risk and suffering. And you're taking away, whereas blood and bone marrow replenish, kidney does not replenish. And there's a potential for developed kidney disease subsequently later on. So these questions have been asked and answered by post-team in adult donation, and adults are allowed to serve as a donor. But is a child allowed to serve as a donor? Can you subject a child who is not a bar doc to such a scenario, in such a case? And in fact,
that she's 13.
Yeah.
Ah, we didn't get that right. But how do we define adult versus they define? How do we define adult versus a love? What happens? She happens to be 13. And she's actually not a minor from our perspective. She's actually adult. She would be considered a full adult. But if you look at page 161, the journals maintain that if there's the age of assent, we'll summarize it, the age of assent, that it is possible for children to serve as a kindergartner, but if they are not the age of assent, they are a 3-year-old or 4-year-old, even if in theory they're the only donor, many medical organizations will not harvest a kidney in that kind of scenario. Because the risk is too great to perform a procedure on someone who is unable to understand what they're doing, as opposed to risk middle, which is a relatively small risk.
Yes, right. I'm surprised that the Leishman of Brown has a therapeutic gamble on bone marrow. Sort of goes against everything. You know, we're raised very proactive in this, and I kind of, not a kidney. They said it's our ego. That's like, you know, I think,
especially now when the procedure is much less risky.
Right.
I mean, initial procedure, you have to do general anesthesia, and they have to actually puncture multiple times.
Yeah, but like you said, it's for the benefit of the child, obviously.
Right.
And a lot of, in other cases, always recognize that. So why is here?
I think it's really just showing the sensitivity to the fact that doing a procedure and someone who's unable to understand the consent of the procedure needs thought. I don't think it's an imposter. I think if he was sitting on the committee, most likely, if he was the only donor, he probably would agree that the donation should be done. But I think it's an indication of sensitivity to the procedure that's going in. So bottom line, halakhically, and we'll just spend the next, we'll conclude in 2 minutes. The bottom line, halakhically, is that there is a difference among Kostim and Zolderjee, for example, does not maintain that a child under the age of bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah can serve as a kidney donor under any circumstances, even if they're at the age of assent. I believe that's correct. Even if they're at the age of assent. And there are others who maintain that if they're at the age of assent, they could indeed serve as a kidney donor. One final thought about compelling donation, just reflected in this case we will put. The tragic case which happened in there in Israel a short time ago, about the concept of can you compel donation or not. Now let's say you have, when they ask you case one, just a very brief answer. You have somebody who is found to be an HLA match. They undergo the bone marrow drive. You know, many of us have signed up, and we should all sign up to be bone marrow donors. It's a very simple thing to do. And you can save a life with very little effort. And they call you on the phone and say, you have found to be a match to an individual. Does halacha say that you are obligated to serve as a bone marrow donor to this person? Yes or no?
No.
Why not?
Because you have
to undergo
a risk, and you're not obligated to put yourself at a risk.
Okay. Fair enough.
I would say yes, that the risk is very small. You're not asking for the kidney.
The risk is small, the benefit is great.
Depends on the condition.
Employing Rabbi Dr. Benning, some studies not only for the patient of Osama al-Dan Riyafa, in fact, there's a community obligation of Osama al-Dan Riyafa. One could argue, and in fact what Mike and others do argue, that you can compel somebody to serve as a bone marrow donor in that scenario because the benefit is extraordinary, the risk is small, and we have a society have an obligation to make sure that this person fulfills Los Angeles Dharma. But others argue and say, exactly like you, if there's still risk involved, I can't compel. What about this case? In this case, this is a real life case, an unofficial case, this is our final case of the day. A woman agreed to be a bone marrow donor, and the way bone marrow donation works, they have to eradicate the bone marrow in the recipient before they perform the donation. So the way this proceeded, this recipient underwent bone marrow eradication. Once they undergo bone marrow eradication, they have no bone marrow. Cannot fight any infections at all, and it is certain they will die if they don't receive a bone marrow transplant. At that stage, the person who had agreed to donate before decided she did no longer want to donate and refused to donate. What's the halacha? What would secular society say? Put your head in the secular courts in that scenario. What would secular society say in that case?
She agreed and she signed consent for it to go and compel it. confront her.
Will they tie her down, take her to the hospital, and say you're a forced donor?
No.
You have the right to change your mind, even though your change of mind results directly or indirectly, really, in the death of this recipient. Yes.
If the donor was paid a dollar or a penny in consideration as a contractual obligation, how would we theoretically secure court order to compel to anesthetize it, put it on the genocide and extract the marrow? But I don't know how what shelf life of the eradicated patient is, whether the patient would expire before the appeals were over.
So that's an excellent legal analysis. I think also you'd be hard pressed to find a judge who would compel this person to undergo anesthesia and do it.
If you were a judge, you would do it, then you wouldn't have to pop out there.
They should do a financial transaction, even if it's minimal, because there's so much risk to the recipient.
Right, that's the side that you're not going to address. They recently legalized these forms of receiving compensation in the United States. But from a legal perspective, do you think you can compel it? Do you think you can not compel it? So this is all the other, and that's the Moshe Sternberg, actually, and this is the recent issue of Asya. Said that indeed, in this case, halakhically, it would be permitted to compel patients to undergo the procedure because they are directly responsible, having consented initially and allowing the patient to undergo the eradication of the bone marrow for the potential death of that patient. The actual postscript is this woman was not compelled, did not perform the donation, and the patient tragically died in that case. Terrible, terrible outcome. But the principles that we would apply in the halakhic world would allow us, in the halakhic universe, to compel these patients to undergo the disease. Including in this conference, it's been really extraordinary conference. We had an opportunity to apply some of these principles in practical fashion to something as mundane as a novel and a movie. When we leave this room and we go on to continue for the next year, if we can survive until the next year, if we have the conference. We begin to see the ethical dilemmas that are in many of our aspects of our daily life, and by the principles that we receive here at this time. So, try to hold me up.
1 minute. I absolutely just want to conclude with a tremendous thanks to all of our speakers. They have been amazing. It has been absolutely wonderful. And I would like to thank all the participants for coming and for planning it's our turn to say thank you, Ilana, wherever you may be, the one who knows where it is, and Jay as well. In the spirit of the Kima Shah, Hadron Allah, we hope to see you again, we hope to return again. We have a day, the CME certificate on your way out. You will get one, drop off your evaluation, have a safe trip, enjoy, and we look forward to seeing you again.